Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise and the sunny slave South Pacific Fukushima irradiated coast, where everybody sunbathes by soaking up the rays. And also, it is of note to mention that many people have now started to realise that seasons are changing. You know, summer in New Zealand is just about to start to end and all of these kind of things. Hey, look, life has its bright sides and its dark sides, but as long as you survive, it's all right. And my very special guests today are Verstein Henry and April Bowden. Welcome to the show, girls.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us on, Vinny.
I know. This is great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, you must know the drill by now. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
I'll go first. Let me see. We have a talk show called Truth or Talk. You can visit our website. It's truthortalk.com. April, did you want to...
Well, yeah, Verstein and I are Truth or Talk. Verstein and I have been friends for many, many years. We met in college about 15 years ago or so, and we've known each other for a lot of years. And we had, I would say, within the last 5 years or so, what many people on your show would probably describe as an awakening, or, you know, kind of recognizing the truth of these things that are going on, the things that you talk about on your show. And so we spent about a year or so, or 2 years, talking about it, just the two of us, because I think we had you on our show, Vinny, and you talked about the loneliness of sometimes when you go through these awakening processes, and we actually had each other, which was very cool. And and that was very comforting, I think, to the both of us. And so what we decided to do was take it on air, and that's hence how Truth or Talk was born.
Well, it sounds like a bright idea, isn't it? I think what happens to a lot of people is that they lose all their friends, not just all but one, but all their friends, and they realize that they were hanging out in an entirely slave circle with people who were really, really receptive to the programming, and they do exactly what the program tells them to do, ostracize people like us, because we're dangerous to the system.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. We talk about losing friends in the show a lot, but also gaining friends, because I think since we woke up, so to speak, we've lost friends, but then we've actually had some really really cool friends come into our life too.
You know,
really, really awesome kindred spirits. Sorry, go on.
It's kind of like a social panhandling experience, you know, where you dip your plate into this dirt of society and then you gradually shuffle it away and virtually nothing is left but a few specks of beautiful gold.
Mm. Oh, wow. Really good analogy.
That is a good way to put it. Yeah, and we've had some really, really great friends and some great experiences as part of this. But it was just interesting because we both came to this kind of awakening. And I think for for us, it had a lot to do with the health movement. As I mentioned to you, Vinny, when you were on our show, that I have a vaccine-damaged son. He's autistic. And so discovering the vaccine thing and what was going on with those, because once that happened, you know, I sort of dug myself into this years and years of research of what is this? Why is this going on? Why did this happen to my son? And I wanted to know, because I wanted to help him, and but I was also curious, and I also wanted to understand, you know, if this was happening to him, was this happening to other people? You know, I sort of came to that later. At first, just kind of discovering it for myself, and Verstine as well. You know, had some experience with her asthma, and you know, so we were thinking. Go ahead, Verstine.
I'm sorry. No, I was going to say I have an vaccine injured cousin, but I wasn't. I didn't really get it until actually. What I saw what happened to your son, because I still even think at that moment when my cousin was injured, she lived far away. I was still kind of detached, you know, from the situation until I put April in touch with my cousin, and then they started talking, and then April started doing research, and, you know, it all just kind of came together for me, too.
Yeah.
So.
Right, and so the health aspect was a huge part, I think, of our awakening. Because then once you start looking at, you know, what these vaccines are and what they're doing to people's bodies, and then you go, okay, well, not only are they hurting people, but they're actually not even effective. So why are we giving them to people if they're not even helping? And once you research the history of something, for example, like polio, now the official story is that Jonas Salk cured polio with the polio vaccine. But then when you research that, you go, oh, well, that didn't happen at all, because polio was actually being – it wasn't a very – it wasn't a very serious illness until they had started introducing these pesticides. And that was the real history of it, is that it had to do with these pesticides, DDT, and this lead arsenic that was in our environment. And that was what was causing people to have massive paralysis, cases of paralysis. So once you know that, you go, well, there's something, there's got to be something more to it, you know, because obviously there's a cover-up. So what's happening? And then once I discovered that there was a cover-up, I started researching the history of vaccines, and it sort of led me to other areas, other facets of what we would describe as the New World Order, you know, this globalist agenda. And so, exactly. You know? So we started off from a health aspect, you know, trying to fix our own problems, you know, from within, for Christine's health issues and my son's health issues. And so, and that, that led us down this road. And so I first started writing about it. We both write, and I started writing essays, and then, everything just kind of snowballed and evolved into our show, which we have now, Truth or Talk. So,
You know, I wrote an essay once, and he and he sent me a letter back, and he said, "Hey, thanks for writing me, essay."
you're silly, Vinny, but I love it. It's great.
I do too. Yeah, it's really funny.
Hey, and I was going to say as well. I love the what happens is when you get into this movement, there's many, many different ways of getting into the truth, right? For you guys, it was for health. For me, it was for the drug war. For many other people, there's all different sorts of things. And I find it's whatever you've actually suffered from, as in there's so many splinter cell fractals of New World Order scumbaggery going on at all different times that it's affecting everybody in some way, shape, or form. But they don't recognize that it's all coming from the same source kind of thing. And so you develop this bias based on which particular traumas the scumbaggery has caused upon you. And for you guys, it was this BS health system. And then as soon as you start looking into it, then it's kind of like if you've ever seen the Star Wars movies or whatever – or a space battle. You can imagine kind of like a missile that gets fired into a giant space station, and then that space station gets blown up, and all these parts start jutting out in every single direction into space. Okay, that's what I think is really so compelling about talking about things like conspiracies and sensor technologies and all of these various eclectic fields of research that we've now got available to us thanks to the internet and talk shows like yours. This is what's happening, though, is because it splits into so many fractals, so many areas of research. It's sometimes very paralyzing for people to just make a choice and go, yeah, we're going to do this in order to help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, you get kind of overwhelmed. It's almost like too much information at once. And, you know, I don't know. It just kind of hit me all at once, you know, and I didn't really necessarily feel overwhelmed by it. I literally, in my brain, and I'll tell you what happened, Vinny, because I was researching the vaccines, as I had mentioned, and it had a lot to do with Bill Gates. I mean, in his own kind of arrogance that he puts out the information, he tells you he's depopulating and he's telling you he's doing these things, I think he gives himself away if you're really paying attention. And so when I saw that, I went, oh, okay, and like a domino effect, I could see in my mind, literally, it looked like a domino or like a helix, like something was sort of, all these connections were sort of branching, things were kind of working together, and I could say, okay, so then you have this global warming thing, I've been kind of questioning that, oh, you've got this 9/11 thing, I've been kind of questioning that a little bit, but now it all kind of is clear. It's like I can kind of see how all these things are sort of a web, you know, and they all just work together. This is, you know, one thing leads to another and so on and so forth. And so it just sort of clicked, you know what I mean? I just kind of went, oh, that's it. That's what this is. This is all about, there's some kind of eugenics depopulation agenda, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. You see all the things
they're just,
that are going
on. Just
put
these really stupid people in power, you know?
Right.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, otherwise it just doesn't make any sense. And then there's, you know, there's levels to it, the scumbaggery, as you put it. You know, there's people who are on top. There's this oligarchy system. There's just a few who really kind of know what's going on. And then there's this trickle down of just people that are just scumbags. And then there's douchebags. And then there's incompetence, where it's just like the most of people in government. They're not really, you know, out there to kill, or they really have no higher knowledge of any agenda. But they're just really, really incompetent. They get into this system that's just designed to just do nothing and be useless. And so, you know, you have that whole structure, and but it just all kind of became clear to me at once. I don't know how else to explain it other than that. And it was just it was Bill Gates himself, in his own kind of, you know, just the way, his tenacity and his just arrogance, and how he just is in your face about what he's doing, but then tries to make it out like a good thing. But I could just see right through it, you know.
Well, he's a snake oil salesman, isn't it? I mean,
I mean,
people don't get this. How exactly could you get people to agree to do something that's really, really bad for them and has no justification whatsoever? Mm-hmm. How is it ever going to be good for anybody to get people to agree to that, if not through getting them to agree to it through deception? All right.
Exactly.
I mean, think about it. Just in the New Zealand example, and the examples stretch all the way around the world, land rates, the rates that you pay just to sit on your own land that you own, allegedly, have gone up for everybody, amidst the government amalgamating everybody's local democratic representation, mind you, claiming that it will help them to come down, and only increase them further, even by 10% per year in some cases. You know, this is talking about a massive agenda at play and a huge amount of money. Can you have any idea how frustrating it must be for them to have all this power and all this money, and just a few people who have got very little of either can actually just oppose them quite easily and expose their scumbaggery? I think it's brilliant.
Hmm.
I mean, they're playing against a stacked deck. Isn't that interesting? It takes like 10 or 20 of them or whatever to repress one of us.
Yeah.
If not more. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. That's how much of a pain in the ass we are. People don't realize this, you know. They're like, oh,
right.
you'll never win. You'll never be successful, you know. All you're going to do is get yourself killed and what have you. It's like, dude, do you think that by not resisting, because you're afraid that they'll wind up persecuting you and killing you, will prevent their agenda to persecute and kill you anyway?
Yeah, right. I was going to say they're killing us anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, anyone who goes along with it, you know, if you know historically, I mean, in the Nazis, I mean, those guys all went down. You know, anybody who was going down, they took everybody out with them. You know, so if you just go along to get along, you're not safe by any means.
Yeah.
If anything,
yeah.
They eat their own more than they do us as the outsiders. You know, as we see, we talk a lot about people who kind of are in the medical industry and they stand out, like a Dr. Andrew Wakefield or somebody like that, who have the gall to say, well, you know, I researched this and I looked at these MMR vaccines and I felt that it was causing some problems and so we need to investigate this some more. Well, I mean, it's the axe for that guy because he's in the medical industry. But I mean, people like us, you know, we can just talk and talk and talk and, you know, we're fine. Yeah. But when you're in it and you're going along to get along, forget about it, you know.
Yeah, because you're blackmailable. And I always thought about the stupidity of getting involved with criminal organizations like this. You know, just get involved with dangerous people, get rewarded handsomely, but at the end of the day, you're dealing with really dangerous people on a day-to-day basis, you know. Oh, right. I'm just going along to get along. Well, you know, I heard this other thing that they were planning to escape into underground bases, you know, like if the world turned to crap or they've deliberately turned it to crap and released bioweapons or something like that. They've got all these big alleged massive underground bases, underground cities all over the place. And they all want to lock themselves down there for like 100 years until things cool down. Then they come back up and start repopulating and everything. Okay. Sounds like a brilliant idea, doesn't it? Except about the part about being locked underground in the dark with the world's worst psychopaths, pedophiles and scum that have ever been known.
That's so funny. You're right.
It's true. It's like I'll take my chances with the zombie apocalypse any day, you know. Yeah. I'd rather than be locked down with those guys.
At least the zombies won't torture and rape me, you know, in a satanic ritual.
That's right. Well, you got a fighting chance. I mean, those people and the fact that do they trust one another? I mean, I doubt it. You know, I'm sure that they all probably hate each other because they're just, you know, have just such an evil agenda. I mean, how could you trust somebody if you know what they're planning and that they're doing all these things?
Or
what
they're capable of, you know?
Yeah. Like, do you think the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds really like each other? I doubt it.
So we're their common enemy, but I'm sure if we weren't, you know, they would be fighting amongst each other.
I mean, well, look at the Kennedy family. I mean, they just, you know, they're in it. I mean, they're part of the royalty or they're part of that oligarchy, but then they seem to always be taking them out, you know? Same people that they are, you know, in sort of working with are also the same people that are taking them out. So, I mean, I don't know. You step out of line, watch out.
Watch your back, man. He's going down.
But exactly.
These are the pieces of meat that are held out for the media. And I think what happens is that people don't realize how little they matter to those above them. You know, anybody ever been an employee and had an employer that didn't like you?
Yeah, of course. Sure.
Yeah. Your life becomes really hard because they can decide your fate. And they don't seem to give a frack about whether or not you've got a family to feed, do they? It's like that, except they're also able to kill you and get away with it.
Okay,
you with hugely damning credible evidence that they had to have on you in order to invite you into the club in the first place and tell you if you say anything that we'll release all of this and all of this will happen to you.
I think they think of us as like roaches. That's what I see. Or like insects, you know. So it's not even like an employee, but it's just something that they hate. And that's just like in their way or we're disposable.
Well, see, in so doing, I think we've defined the real meaning of power over somebody. You stop caring about people who don't have any power. You know? Think about this. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of there was a jail experiment. They locked up students. I think they made half the students guards or half the students think. I forget the exact numbers or whatever. But what they found is that only after a day or two or 3 days or something, the students who were playing the guards, who had all the power, and the prisoners who had no rights, the interaction between them, the prisoners just started to get treated awfully. Terribly, violently, deceptively, and they were monitoring all of this as it would happen, and they were like, holy cow. Now, I think that's the problem with society in and of itself, the appeal to authority. Nobody should have it.
Definitely.
I don't think such a thing as authority exists to a degree, right? There's no actual real authority in terms of, I can tell you what to do and force you to do it, and have that be totally okay. Maybe in parenting, sure. But adults doing that to other adults forcibly, I don't think is good. For example, I was at this dance party festival over the weekend. As I said, one of my listeners got me a volunteer role on that, and that was pretty hard work, but yeah. This one dude, we were sitting there directing traffic and pedestrians. Pedestrians had to go down one line to go check through security so they can rifle through your bags and pull out all your alcohol and then drink it later, you know. And yeah. Direct the cars into the car park. This one guy wouldn't go through the security check. You know, he's just wearing shorts and carrying an umbrella. He probably didn't have anything on him. And he recognized me as I was telling him to go down the security line. And he starts talking about colour of law and things like this. Now, that aside, you're at a private event, which you bought a ticket for, and he's saying, I don't have to abide by the rules because it's colour of law. Do you think that sounds a little bit stupid? You know, maybe a misuse of the common law practices and the reasons that you're supposed to be, you know, doing things and what have you? I think so, maybe a little. But then again, was I prepared to violently restrain him and force him to go through a security check that he refused to go through? No. Were any of the security guards, other than me, willing to do that? No. Why? Because this person had damaged no property and had hurt nobody. And I think as long as you don't do either of those two things, nobody should ever touch you or force you to do anything.
True. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Vinny, I'm kind of curious because when we had you on your show, you talked about how when you were arrested for possession of weed a couple times. And so once in a while, people will send things and they say, because here in the United States, I don't know what the laws in New Zealand are now. I know you got arrested for it before, but here it's many states, it's still illegal to possess it. And, you know, people want to appeal to the government and ask them for permission. What do you think about that? Like, do you think that we are even needing to ask them permission, or should you just be able to just do it if you want to?
Well, I got charged with possession for supply, which is an indictable charge, which comes with a minimum sentence of like up to 8 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. For 13 grams.
Wow.
That's how serious it is in New Zealand. It's manslaughter. Serious. You know, if you accidentally kill somebody in your car, you can get a similar sentence to if somebody catches you with a couple of grams of weed that is for sale.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
That's heavy. Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
So I was facing that as a 19-year-old kid.
Sure.
All of a sudden.
Jeez.
Oh, yeah. It was tough. It was tough. You know, even thinking about it. You never get over that kind of shock to the system. Just boom. Far out. But that aside, should I have had that happen to me or not happen to me? Let's think about this. How much damage was happening because I was selling weed? How many people got hurt or badly traumatized or had their lives destroyed as a result of the drug? Mm-hmm. Probably none. How many people got traumatized and had their entire life destroyed? It was just me, okay? So was it the drug that did that to me, or was it the law that did that to me?
It was the law. It was the law.
Yeah.
You know, April and I were talking not too long ago about how people are a slave to regulations. You know how there's this case that just happened where there's this boy that was, like, dying, and his parents were forced to come in and make him take a standardized test, even though he was dying. And we were saying, at what point do, you know, the person that had to make that phone call, what point do you, do you say to yourself, I'm not going to call this kid's parents and make him come in and take a standardized test? Because it's a stupid law. Like, you know, morally it's wrong, or it's a stupid rule or regulation, but because it seems like people don't have they've lost their moral compass because they're relying on this, like, regulations or appeal to authority.
There is only one word. I think there's only one word that really gives you power in the face of authority. No.
No. Yeah. And then some people can't take it. You tell them no, and it's like you may as well have shot them, because, you know, there are people that feed off that power too. There are people that feed off of. They love being told what to do because they don't want to take responsibility. And then there are people that like telling people what to do because they have no self-esteem or control issues, or they're a psychopath or what have you.
Yeah, we've all got our little problems, don't we? And unfortunately, the people who really don't want to control other people invariably don't seek positions of overarching power and control. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the problem. Yeah. Those kind of people who don't want to be in power and control, ironically, they're the ones who should be in power and control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of like in every story, too. I mean, if you take like anything from Greek mythology or even modern mythology, like Star Wars or The Lord of the Rings, you know, it's always the people who want power, they're kind of, you know, intrinsically kind of evil, you know, that are seeking it. And then those who really should be your leaders, you kind of have to coax them and force them into it. Like, oh, we need you. We need somebody like you who's not going to, you know, be corrupt and not take over and not try and, you know, just use this power to destroy everybody. It's like, it's sort of a well-known thing. It's kind of interesting how, you know, if you know anything about like Joseph Campbell mythology, he says, we kind of are born knowing a lot of this stuff. We sort of recognize it. We see these things around us, and these stories are recycled over and over and over again because they're true. But a conspiracy theorist is sort of somebody who is crazy or has a tinfoil hat or something like that. But it's everywhere and it's in everything. It's if you look at the Bible or if you look at, you know, any of these classic stories, it's like it's been around for how long? You know, these people who.
Forever.
Exactly. They get corrupt with their powers and or seek power because they are corrupt or because they are, you know, they do, you know, want power over others and such like that. So, it's kind of interesting. And then those who don't want power really aren't the ones, you know, you're not going to go out and seek it. Go ahead, Vinny.
G. Edward Griffin started up Freedom Force International because he wanted to train people how to, like, campaign for local government and things of that nature. And it's titles in Latin, I think it's Datis Libertatum Non Possunt or something like that. And it says, those without power cannot defend freedom. And I think what the New World Order is adept at is convincing people that they have no power, convincing us of this this learned helplessness that everybody's talking about.
Learned's a great word, yeah, because we are very powerful, but we, you know, I think especially when you wake up, you get inundated with a lot of information and you get inundated with all of the so-called sinister plans that you feel that it's too big for you, you know, but you forget that they're doing all this because you are very powerful and you're kind of taught to be helpless, you know, you're kind of taught to that too, also through the appeal to authority. Because, you know, we're taught to basically worship or seek somebody else out for the answer instead of looking toward or inward, you know, toward ourselves. And that's a form of, or that's a way of being taught helplessness, I guess, you know, like even with doctors, like April was talking about how we woke up and that was, you know, largely through the health industry. And, you know, doctors are deified and, you know, people aren't really taught to question doctors and people are always taught, you know, whether inadvertently or inadvertently that doctors are, you know, are gods. And if you question them, you know, something's wrong with you or you are a deviant or you're immortal, basically. Yeah. So that's why you end up, you know, with all of these people that are vaccine injured or die, get cancer, but die of the chemotherapy treatment or, you know, and any other disease that can be basically cured, you know, self-cured. But, you know, we're looking for doctors to give us the answers when we have the answers ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anti-science. That's the popular
God
amongst them. They
that's
like to
just
say
anti-science.
That,
yeah.
Right, as if it's, you know, science.
It's like
is
a slur.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
And these people who work in these positions, I mean, they go to school and they do all of that, but that doesn't make them divine. That doesn't give them sort of the understanding.
But a lot of people
of
think
God.
It does, though. That's the thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? They get caught up in that because they sacrifice so much of their their lives, or you know, in school, like a decade or more, maybe school.
The whole system is designed for that appeal to authority endlessly, isn't it? You know, you go.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my earliest memories was like playing in a sandpit or something like that in kindergarten, and you know, teachers told me to stop doing something or whatever, and it's straight away, you know. You only just come into this world and all of a sudden you've got people telling you what to do. And you grow up not knowing anything different.
Right.
Well, but I mean, if you're a little boy and a teacher, there's a little... Don't you think you need it a little bit? A little bit. You know, you just... The well, teacher shouldn't go crazy with their power.
However, there is, of course, what is known as moral uses of force.
Yeah.
You know, self-defense or things of that nature. I was suspended a total of 17 times from high school, and I think maybe 5 of those times was because I was getting beaten up and defending myself. Mm. You know, I don't think I should have been suspended those times. The other times, absolutely, I was totally unjustified in my behaviour. I was a real troubled kid. But that stopped when my mum hired this guy to come round and hang out with me once a week, named Derek, and we just basically hung out and talked. Just having a male role model around, even for that short period of time every week, made a huge difference, and I stopped being violent at school. You know, it's actually pretty straightforward. If you change the environment to boys needing men around them, and women and girls needing women around them, you know, everybody balances out really well if they have a stable parental relationship in the family unit. If you have bad relationships with your father for girls, you wind up having bad relationships with men. If you don't have your father in the home for all or most of your life as a boy, you're like 7 times more likely than anyone else to get a criminal conviction. You know, the statistics are right there. And the family... in and of itself, is under attack, you know. And particularly the institution of marriage. When was the last time you ever saw on TV or movies or anything a positive mention about marriage? And how many times have you heard them making jokes about it and degrading it?
It's always like War of the Roses or, you know, or, yeah, they're at each other's throat or, you know. Right. Yeah. But, you know, there's also this flip side, too. There's this, like, my vocabulary is just leaving me today. I'm just going to say thing. I can't think, lack of a better word.
For an English teacher, that's not a good sign, girl.
I know. Come on, dude. Give me, I think I'm on overload. Yeah. Custom tradition in society too, that's saying that you actually have to be married by a certain age or, you know, to be happy. Have you heard of this book called The Rules, Vinny?
No, I'm not a fan of rules.
No, but there's a book that came out a few years ago called The Rules, and it's basically a book written by women.
Doesn't sound like a book that I'd read, eh?
No, but I'm just saying, but we, you know, we have these, you know, as far as marriage on the subject of marriage, you know, all these little, like, things like that, like books, like telling you how to manipulate people into being with you in order to be happy. So it's kind of like this, it's like a shtick, I don't know. Help me out, April. What do you call it? Like,
well, I think what we're describing is that it's coming on from both sides of it. You know, if like you're saying, there's we're sort of demonizing the institution of marriage, making it seem like it's such a negative thing, and then on the other side of it, there's these people who actually prey upon those who are single and say that they are wrong or they haven't. Or that they need to get married by a certain age, or you have to do certain things in order to land your man. Like this book, The Rules, she's talking about teaches women how to manipulate men into marrying them. And so, but the message to women is that you then have to be married, and you have to be married by a certain age, because otherwise you're not, you know, a real woman or something like that, or you're undesirable. But if you can, go ahead.
No, no, go on, go on.
I was interviewing a PhD professor, and he says women control men entirely, and I go how and I go like, what do you mean? He says women can make a man attracted to her, and I go how? She controls sex. It's just that simple.
Right.
Hmm. Well, I didn't mean to cut. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, no. I love you, Ape. You're awesome. That's why you're my co-host. I'm having like a brain fart today. But that's why, you know, you're my co-host. So
all right.
Thank you. You explained exactly what I was trying to say.
Yeah, perfectly. But I think that what you're getting at, Vinny, is I wrote this essay not that long ago, or maybe it has been a while. I just haven't done a lot of writing lately. So it's the last thing I wrote back in October about when I was in college, I had an experience with sort of what would be described as the feminist movement. Because this is part of my awakening too, by the way. When I was growing up, I grew up in a very liberal city, San Francisco. San Francisco here in the United States is a city that's known for, you know, kind of being leftist and sort of on that side of it. And so what I was surrounded with was a lot of these lefties. And I went to college kind of thinking that, you know, feminism, these women who were sort of for women's rights and everything, were very enlightened. And what I discovered when I was in college, I was taking this course on women in American history. And first of all, what I learned during the course was that there wasn't as much oppression as I had thought. There was actually women in power from a very early time. And then the other thing that was even more enlightening was not just what I learned in the course, but actually the response of the women in my class. See, Bill Clinton was president at the time, and Bill Clinton is a rapist. You know, he rapes and molests women. And so what these women were doing was defending him by saying that, you know, he raped this woman in Oxford when he was in college. She was 17, he was 19 or 20 years old, and they went on a date. She went back to his dorm room and he raped her. And what they were saying was that this woman kind of had it coming. You know, and these are supposed to be feminist, Vinny. Like, they're supposed to be kind of defending the woman, right? And they're saying that she had it coming because she shouldn't have been so naive to go back to his room. She should have known better and all of these things. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. They're so caught up in their false right-left paradigm. They're so caught up in wanting to be on the winning team that they were willing to defend a rapist, even though they're supposed to be feminist. So this level of hypocrisy just led me to see it for what it really was, which was just BS. I said, this whole thing is a lie. There's no way that there's, and once you start going down that rabbit hole, you go, oh, actually, I mean, there's a lot too that this was a conspiracy, but and it was set up in order to break up the family, in order to get the people this false sense of inequity, which, because if you think about it, as you're saying, women, you know, control men because they have sex, but in a situation of a crisis, like let's say you're on the Titanic and it's going down, who gets the lifeboat, right? The women. Women and children first, no matter what. No matter if a man gets, you know, if he's got a better chance of survival, she gets to go in the lifeboat first. So how, and then yet, but see, we're given... We're
I
given
love that, of, eh? The juxtaposition. I think there was a great comedian called Bill Burr, and he came up with a sketch on this, and he goes, what feminists have done is they've gone through everything that men and women do and all the things that men do for women, and then just picked all the things that they like and discarded all the rest, you know? Yeah, I want equal pay, equal wages, and equal time off of work and all of that kind of thing, but paying for the movies? Nah, I think the men can keep that one.
Totally. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's, yeah. But I mean, my point is that they're not giving up that. Yeah. They're not giving up the life, I can guarantee you. But then see how that's a contradiction, though, because we're supposed to believe that we're the oppressed, but yet we get the lifeboat every time. You know, that doesn't really make sense, because why wouldn't a man get the lifeboat if he had a better chance of survival? Like, let's say he's, you know, he can hunt and he can fish and he can do all these things. So they find themselves somewhere stranded. He's going to be able to protect everybody better. But he doesn't get the lifeboat. You know, so that was sort of a, once I kind of was, I thought, this is hypocritical. And then, yes, you know, it is breaking up the family. And I think we were talking about not having the father in the home, you know, some of the research that I found led to that, you know, the increase of boys being diagnosed with ADHD is much higher amongst boys who don't have fathers, you know. And there's all kinds of evidence that, you know, they're more likely to be sick, they're more likely to have violence, they're more likely to have, you know, all these other kind of neurological problems. So, yeah, I mean, but on the other side of it, you don't want, you know, people being made to feel guilty, like they have to get married or they have to do all that. So it's sort of, but that's how they divide us. N'est-ce pas? You too? You agree?
Most certainly. One would expect that if you're going to try and run a system that actually runs the people in the system into the ground, then naturally you're going to make them feel like dirt in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after all, a slave who doesn't want to be free because they don't think they're a slave is a hell of a lot easier to control than a slave who knows he's a slave and is really pissed off about it. And I think mm-hmm. what's happening now is... All the slaves are starting mm-hmm. to get really pissed off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope so, right?
I mean, doesn't it actually fill you with a sense of joy that you are a revolting slave?
It does. But sometimes, honestly, I mean, that was a really convincing answer, right? Sorry. It does. Well, for myself, because I feel more enlightened, I feel I have a better understanding about why certain things happen, and that makes me feel empowered. But at the same time, I just wish sometimes I still get this, like, you know, I feel like we're on a time crunch. Come on, you guys. Like, I see our country trying to plot, you know, World War III, and I'm like, come on, you guys, get on it. You know, I don't know. I want them to be more of us. I want us, more people, to become conscious. That's my plight right now.
Now, I think of it as individuals kind of make the difference in any given situation, and the masses really are sheep to a large degree, and they will follow any shepherd that's put in front of them, regardless of whether that shepherd leads you into a slaughterhouse or to greener pastures. I say we start shepherding, you know, actually really caring about other people and also become better shepherds.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's true.
I mean, if you've got the ability to lead and see things like that, I mean, it's incumbent on you. It's actually kind of like a real mark of responsibility that we have as people who know what is going on to stand up and actually be society's leading people. However, this is ironic because none of us want to appeal to authority.
Mm.
Yeah.
But that's where we do need each other, like you say, yeah. Because it's like, as an individual, you know, what are you going to do? Like, when, you know, you got arrested, how are you going to fight that by yourself? I mean, that's a pickle that you can't really, you don't have a choice, because the people with the guns are going to make you go to jail, whether you want to or not. But if we stand up as a group and we say, you know what, we're going to grow this stuff, and sorry, it's a weed and it's natural and screw you, you know, but once you get yeah. into a large enough group, how are they going to stop you, you know? So it's like, we kind of do need I wouldn't say the collective, but we need a community in a way. And so it's, how are you going to prevent people from becoming communities is through division and disempowerment again, you know? I mean, yeah. Back to the feminist thing. The other thing that I recognized was that the feminist movement is based on disempowering women. It actually is disempowering you, because it's telling you that you're a victim. Which isn't really even true. When you look at the history of it, it's not even true. You know, there's always been disenfranchised groups. There's always people that are, you know, there's inequity throughout history of times where, you know, women have been suppressed in some ways, and then in other ways they haven't, and so on and so forth. But, I mean, if you look at it as like, oh, well, you know, they wouldn't allow women to vote. Well, oh, so they got the vote, so now they get to appeal to a false sense of authority. So basically they just got brought down to where the men were anyway. So I don't know. It's just it's interesting, but that's how that works. These systems are actually to then make you feel like you're a victim, and therefore then you're going to appeal to authority to protect you. And ask for equal wages, ask for the right to vote, ask for these things when you really don't even need their permission.
Yeah.
I think
same thing with affirmative action. You know, you can say that.
Yeah, it's quite funny. I strike a soft spot with feminists sometimes. I don't know what it is about me, but they really hate me because I'm not a feminized man. Maybe I don't know, but they I get into these arguments, And eventually it gets to the point of the argument where I've established that they really don't know what they're talking about. They're just being aggressive and rude and all of these terrible things.
And they call you sexist, right? And you're just being sexist.
Yeah. all of that jazz. You know, they're not actually arguing, okay? They're just repeating BS that they've heard before. It's really sad. And what's sadder is that every single time I ask them, let me guess, you're single? They say yes, because they...
You're like, I wonder why.
You can't maintain a relationship with a man if you don't respect him. Relationships are a two-way street, as is respect, okay? You can't bring women up in respect by saying that men are the cause of all problems and we should be damned and have to do everything. You know, it's all more to the point. Actually, you know what feminism's done? It's actually treated women worse than it's treated men. Because now women have to do everything. You have to have a full-time job and be a mother and pay attention to your man and maintain that perfect relationship. No wonder divorce rates are so freaking high. Women have all this pressure on them now. Thank you, feminism, for equalizing the pressure in the relationship by making sure that there isn't one because it's too freaking stressful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's my point. Exactly. Is that they went from being not really being disempowered. But that was a whole fallacy. That was, you know, it wasn't actually true. But like you're saying, there was more, you know, equalness. And a woman's not going to have, like you say, she's not going to have a boyfriend if she thinks men are evil and she thinks that men are, you know, the cause of all of her problems. Then yeah, she's not going to find a man. She's not going to find a boyfriend. It's a two-way street, and we have to recognize that we both have things to offer one another, that we actually need each other. Yeah, we need each other. There's not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what man when he goes out filling out an online dating form? What are you looking for in a woman? Well, I want a woman that hates me, that's argumentative, that's really bitter, that doesn't want to bear my children, and wants to work all the time, and boss me around, and treat me like a slave. There's a huge amount of results. They're awesome. I can take my pick of the litter. Because they're all single.
Exactly.
That's true. Yeah, exactly.
So, and if you know, and then too, if like you don't see the value in men too, because then you'll have all those other women who say, "I can do it all. I can do it all myself." Well, first of all, why would you want to? Because it's a lot of work. And secondly, you know, but then how's a man gonna feel? You know, if he feels emasculated, that he's unnecessary, that a woman can just raise her children and have, you know, do all these things on her own. But you know, it's not true. You know, it's not true at all, and we totally need each other. And that's what we're here for. If it's not to have relationships and to, you know, find love and to find companionship, then what's the point? You know, what are we fighting for?
It's almost like feminism is about a trade. It's trading the masculinity out of men and putting it into women, and trading the femininity out of women and putting it into men, and everything just gets totally jumbled up because people don't know who they are anymore, because what they're being told to think and what their body is telling them are two totally different things.
Oh, wow,
which is a fallacy in itself, because we all have feminine and masculine traits. You know, obviously as a woman you're gonna have more feminine traits than a masculine trait, but you have some, you know. I mean, I have a dirty sense of humor which I could attribute to being kind of a masculine thing. You know, I love the movie The 40-Year-Old Virgin. That's kind of my style of sense of humor. And but guys will say, those are guys movies, you like that? And I go, yeah, I do. I don't know, I can't help it. But I'm mostly pretty feminine other than that. So, but I think guys, you know, if a guy likes to watch the show Sex and the City, that doesn't necessarily mean he's, you know, feminine. But you know, it's just to say that we all have bits and pieces of each other, but that just goes to show how we go together. You know, it's like it's a synergy. We belong to each other. And this sort of, I can do it on my own. I don't need this person, or it's, or, you know, men are, when they're evil because they want sex. No, what are you talking about? You know, you should feel honored
that they want to have sex with you.
Why is that an insult? I'm like, I don't get it.
Oh, I feel so dirty. He wants to give me an amazing screaming orgasm. That's just disgusting.
No, that's a that's an honor. That means that he finds you attractive. What's wrong with that? You know, I don't. I mean, of course, a guy can be sleazy about it, you know. But
I saw this. I saw this picture of Barack Obama leaning in to whisper something into the ear of Michelle Obama just after he won the presidency. It's like, girl, I'm gonna tear that all up.
It was like the caption. They put like a little, what do you call it? Like a box?
Like a little speech bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you don't know. He could have said something like that. Who knows, man?
Yeah.
It's really funny, too, but like the imbalance between men and women and how, like, I notice a lot of men are, or women are taught that it's okay to hit men. I mean, men shouldn't hit women. You know, and women shouldn't hit men. But as a teacher, I see that too. Like, you're teaching the children in school that, well, I don't teach that, but I've seen other students get taught that, oh, okay, women, boys can hit girls, but you know,
I think there's a power disparity.
And
in fact, that was another thing that Bill Burr, the comedian, was talking about feminism, is that the only reason why women can destroy men's lives is because you can't hit them. No, seriously. Think about this.
Yeah, it's true.
If a man came into my room, poured like Coca-Cola acid on my equipment or something like that, and like threw my clothes out onto the lawn and burned them, I would smack the hell out of that guy. But if my but your girlfriend does it, and then she just walks out like, what? You can't do nothing.
Yeah, but you know what? It's true. Like, I had this, we're not friends anymore, but I had this friend, and she was telling me that, you know, how her ex-husband used to, like, hold her down and put his hand over her mouth. And I was like, well, why would he do that? And she was like, oh, yeah, you know, one day he laughed at me, so I beat him with a spatula. And then he restrained me. And I'm just like, well, bitch, you need, oops, I'm sorry, Vinny. You needed to be restrained because you're a rabid dog, you know. And then that's one of the reasons why, or the reason I ended my friendship with her, because she couldn't control her temper. She was very erratic, but yet she said she had all this trouble with men, and you know, with the relationship she was in with men. But it was because of her, and she, you know, she thought it was okay to go crazy on them physically and verbally. But yet, if they did something to protect themselves, then, you know, they were the wrong. They were, you know, in the wrong. So.
Right.
I've taken that upon myself recently as well, because I can get verbally abusive. I haven't actually physically laid a hand on anybody since I was like 15 in high school or something. But yeah, I can get really, really angry and worked up and verbally abuse my wife, and then I hold myself back and I go, oh my God, what am I doing? It's just freaking terrible. And then I actually talk to her about it and really kind of apologize and. I'm slowly learning, and it's gradually getting better and better. But the fact that it's still there, you know, like you've got the streak in you, because it was like, it reminded me of when I was a kid, and I'd throw tantrums and things like that, and I'd go like completely out of control, you know. It's like there's still that part of me that's there that I'm slowly working on trying to get rid of it. Because at my core, when I was born, I was born into a really wealthy household, and I was quite literally, looking back on my behavior throughout those years, a spoiled brat, and in many ways still am. And I'm kind of wrestling with myself, trying to come to terms with it and to solve it before I have kids, you know, so when I pass that kind of spoiled brat behavior onto them.
What are your thoughts on spanking?
I reckon it's fine, you know? I mean, but then again, I wouldn't really use spanking and what have you. I mean, like, if the child's, again, back to common law and natural law, if a child's actually damaging somebody else or somebody's property or something like that, I think it's actually perfectly okay to actually just, you'll only have to do this once or twice in the child's life, and then they'll suddenly get the idea and it'll replicate, is if they cause pain to somebody else, you cause pain to them really, really, really quickly in the exact same way that they just did it to somebody else. So that way they know exactly what they just did and they feel it. I remember when I was in high school, I think I was maybe 11 or 12 or something like that, we learned in high school that women's breasts are very, very sensitive. And I went home and I punched my mother in the breast, you know, and I feel really terrible about it now. I was angry with her and stuff like that, and I just learned this, and I didn't. And then I walked out of the house, and my mother told her boyfriend Barry about it, and he came right over, and he punched me directly in the solar plexus and totally winded me, and like I was down on the ground for like about five minutes or something like that, in frickin' pain, not able to breathe. And he says, "That's what you just did to your mother. Never hit a woman again." Okay. You know, so sometimes the bad things that you do can be the very source, especially if they're reflected back at you quite directly, and your brain makes that connection, right? Like if you had a child who just suddenly scratched you or something like that, you grab their arm and you squeeze, and they go, ow, and then they scratch you again, you grab your arm, you grab their arm and you squeeze just a little hard, and they go, ow, and they scratch your arm again, you squeeze just a little bit harder, ow. And then they stop scratching you, and they never scratch you again. All right. See, this is the thing about physical discipline that people don't understand. It should never involve emotion. All right. If you are physically disciplining your child, you have to be 100% calm, on the ball, responsible adult. You have to care and love as you're doing it. And not convey that this is out of anger or rage, that it is simply trying to inflict a physical lesson upon you and relay it directly to something. If you're just like going out of control or something like that, it's simple. You know, go to your room, time out 5 minutes or something like that until you calm down, and then you come back out. And if you go back in, you check them after 5 minutes. If they haven't calmed down, you go, "Are you ready to calm down and come out?" And they go, "No, no, no." And you go, "Okay." And you close the door and you quickly walk out. There's no arguments. There's no, "Oh, please," or anything like that. It's simply cut off the contact, cut off the appreciation at periods of time until they get the lesson that that behavior is not appreciated, and they replicate the behavior that you do want. Like being a good kid. Having fun and games, not hitting other children, not spitting, not biting, not breaking things deliberately, you know, not being destructive. And that way you manufacture a very positive, caring kid who's going to turn into a really great adult, who's going to find a loving partner and raise really good kids of their own. And that's how you replicate a good lesson through it. And if you come from a violent, abusive kind of family background as I have, the onus is on the child, after it's happened, to get over that stuff and to not make the same mistakes your parents did on you. Otherwise, it's going to repeat down your family line, and that's not good for your bloodline.
Yeah.
Well.
Right, and it's like what you're saying, I think, is something that we've talked about before, that it's about intention. So when you intend to hurt somebody, you're going to, if you're intending to hurt your child because you are a damaged person and you have not addressed your own childhood abuse, which is usually what that is when parents hit their kids, is because they got hit and they don't know the difference between, you know, they can't control their anger. So they lash out on their own child when their child upsets them. But if you intend it to be a lesson and it's not, and you kind of take that away from it and take it out of it. So I think it's about what you're saying as intention. And it's very astute, Vinny, to acknowledge, like, well, you know, I yell at my wife, and to reflect on that and say, you know, why do I do this? Oh, it's because I am, you know, I'm still acting out in that way that I did when I was a kid, that tantruming. Because I think that we learn when we're children ways that we are capable of getting attention. And if you don't get positive attention, you'll seek negative attention. And so in a lot of ways, when we act out it's because we're really looking for attention, or, you know, we just don't have the self-control, you know, because we never were taught to have the self-control, or that, you know, was the only way that we got attention. We get something out of it, you know.
Yeah, and also, if you're hyped up on sugar or very unhealthy, or if you're a parent, very sleep deprived, it is doubly hard to control your temper.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's all that aspect of it too, you know, these environmental toxins and all these things that we're exposed to. And then we don't even necessarily even think about that. But I mean, you have to look in, and I think what we were touching on before when you were on our show, and maybe we even talked about it a little bit today, is this: when you're in this sort of movement, this truth movement, there's some sort of like level of introspection that has to go on. Like you're saying, how, you know, it's not about waking up other people. It's about finding, you know, what I can do to be a better person, or what I can, and then, and a lot of that starts with your relationship with your closest people, your spouse, your children, you know, your parents, and learning to forgive, you know, yourself at times, but then also just reflect on like, well, why do I do this? Why do I act out this way? And then maybe that will, you know, once you see it, then you can kind of stop yourself when you're doing it the next time. Yeah. And it gets kind of easier to control.
Well, it's about self-improvement. And I've said for a long time that the essence of being good is about restraint, things that you won't do under any circumstances. And the essence of evil is precisely the opposite, that you will not restrain yourself from doing anything you want.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, what this sort of system that we're talking about, these oligarchs or these people who are in positions of power, these few, is that they prey upon the, I guess, your victimhood, or you as a, and then going back to the whole feminist thing, that was the kind of the point that I was making with it. A lot of what the feminists do is they disempower themselves by saying, you know, I was a victim, I was raped, I had this problem, or, you know, men are evil because they do these things and they want sex from women, or so on and so forth. So I'm disempowered, I'm a victim, and you know, feel sorry for me, which, you know, which isn't necessarily true. You're kind of taking out what happened to you maybe as a child, you know, if you were molested or if something happened to you when you were younger, but then you're sort of, you know, generalizing it to the mass population, not necessarily recognizing that's not normal male behavior. You know, there's only a few people that actually do those things. And that's what these oligarchs do to us too, you know. They make it seem like this is what humanity is, but it's really not. It's just you few people that are doing all these things. You know, the mass majority of people aren't doing those things to each other. You know, they're actually, but, you know,
you don't really see stories on the news about how a father and mother lovingly raised their parents to be healthy adults, do you? No.
Yeah.
But if they chain them in the basement or something like that and rape them and have several children from their own children,
right.
Boy, everybody hears about that, don't they?
Yeah.
What examples are we putting out for people? See, this is what MTV's about, I think, is that all you're putting out is these really beautiful young girls who are, you know, all right with Jesus and very clean cut and what have you, and then they come of age and turn into super prostitutes.
Yeah, and bathe in bathtubs of blood, and like the satanic aspect too of the you know, of MTV.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
It's grooming, pedophile grooming. I think a little bit of that.
Pedophile murder. I mean, a lot of things on the dark side. You know.
Oh yeah,
stuff. It's terrible.
Like, have you noticed, like, I don't know if this is different for a man or a woman. I think it affects us the same. Just the word pedophile. You know? It's horrific. Just the thought that somebody could rape children. Oh, my God. And why do you think it's so rampant? It's because it's so disgusting that nobody wants to hear about it or solve it.
I talk about it, yeah. Right. Oh, it's so rampant. Yeah.
Right, and especially where we are here in Southern California, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I mean, these children who go into Hollywood, and, you know, you see time and time again, they become drug addicts as adults. They're really, really messed up. You know, they go into crime. They do all these things, and you're like, what happened to these kids? Like, why were they, you know, but because they get into these situations when they're very, very young, where they're put around other adults, and these adults are pedophiles, and they're preying on them. And so by the time they're adults, they don't know how to manage their lives. They have no perception of reality, and then they're thrown out into the wilderness just to fend for themselves. It's, you know, you see it over and over and over again. And I think we talked about this recently on our show, this, like, I don't know if you saw this, but the actor Corey Feldman had come out and talked about the biggest problem in Hollywood is pedophilia. But, you know, nobody talks about it because, I mean, he did, but I think they're very afraid to discuss it and to get into it because, you know, then they get their careers ruined, or they, you know, or even worse.
Here's another aspect.
Also, their parents also pimp them into it. You know, they don't really have
exactly.
A lot of the parents know what's going on, but they want the fame so much, they don't care. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm sorry, go on.
I forgot what I was about to say. It was about one of the aspects of the pedophilia cases is just looking into them. This is what I remembered. Yeah. Just looking into this stuff in detail traumatizes you. You haven't even experienced any of it directly yet. Just hearing about it, just hearing people's testimony, actually you feel pain. You kind of you feel sick. It's almost like it's happening to you to a degree, very much less degree, of course, but because these people pour out that pain onto you. We talked to you earlier about energy vampires, and I think there's two types of energy vampires: those who do the traumatizing and those who have been thoroughly traumatized. You know, you ever sat with somebody who's been so thoroughly traumatized, and they keep telling you all this bad stuff that's happened to you, and you just feel drained, and you can't listen to them anymore, and you kind of want to turn them off, you want to look away, the same way that you want to turn off the television when you see starving children in Africa. We don't want to see that stuff. We don't want to hear it. Because it actually gives us pain, and we've all got enough pain in our own freaking lives, don't we? You know?
Yeah.
And so everybody just becomes despondent and just goes, everybody needs to just take care of themselves, which, you know, ironically is kind of the way it should be. But the problem is not only just taking care of yourself, but you also got to really take care of the people around you, you know? Community has to work and what have you. And if everybody knew each other, if everybody cared about each other, if everybody was willing to listen to all of these terrible stories that are coming out about the pedophile rings and everything like that, do you think a really, really wise bunch of people who protected their community would just sit by and watch this happen? No, they wouldn't.
No.
So fortunately, though, for the abusers, the legislation is written by people who protect the abusers.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Look at it this way. You've got a system that abuses children that writes its own laws and defines what is and isn't legal. And that's how children are treated here in New Zealand, at least.
Oh, all over the world, though, you know? And then there's this weird, like, I don't know if you call it a phenomenon or just with the elite, they have these pedophile rings and they do all of these weird occult sacrifices. I mean, what is that about? You know, why are they so obsessed with that? And I think it's some form of like energy stealing or something. You know, I don't really know, but it's just so rampant, not only in society but also even within the elite, but they take it to the extreme because they do like sacrifices and all this stuff. Like, what is up with that? What are your thoughts on that?
Ooh. Yeah, I interviewed Tila Tequila one time, and she said that there's underground cults and things like that where they literally drink people's blood. I've talked to a number of session musicians, Ricky Ray, for example, who was pretty well involved in Hollywood, that says that all of the stuff really does go on, and you'd be surprised how often it goes on and how big a body count it's got. I mean, it's almost like a pharaoh sitting there
And in order for Pharaoh to be satisfied, a certain number of virgins or animals or something of that nature will have to be sacrificed, okay, just to make sure Pharaoh's happy. And what these people do is they don't just sacrifice, animals and what have you, although I've heard allegations that stuff does go on as well, and bestiality and all forms of debauchery, but they really are... at least this is the belief structure that I've come to understand it as, they steal a form of emotional energy. It's like they literally feed off of it. I had this interview with some people about the djinn or psychopaths or these mind parasites kind of thing. And he showed me a little photograph of one of these parasites. I'm not sure if it was real or whatever, but what they all agree is that these parasites can actually replicate themselves. They're capable of attaching to another person's brain stem and copying itself and then infecting the host and turning them into a psychopath as well. Right? And so that's really scary because it means if you're hanging around with psychopaths all the time, you become one of them. Right? Maybe this is part of the reason why all of these Hollywood people ain't frickin' standing up and saying something is because they're being infected slowly one by one. It's like on the Body Snatchers, really. In a very real sense, this is like the Body Snatchers. They snatch your mind instead of your body.
So there's no way to defend against these things?
There's always defenses against all kinds of things. Belief in God, for example, is one thing that'll help you defend against them. Running the frack away from them and never wanting to be involved with them, that's a good way to defend against them.
There are no like laser beams you can like shoot at them or anything.
Well, I don't
kidding.
Well,
go
what
on.
We know is what we do know
I believe,
is but what some of these other people are alleging is that they actually need us. They need us to feed on, much like a vampire. If there's no pain or suffering or control and worship of them, they die. The parasite dies. Literally, if you deprive one of these psychopathic parasites of power, access to people, and pain and fear of other people around them to feed off, the parasite starves to death. I'm not sure what happens after that, because it just says you put a psychopath on a desert island, he'll die, pretty quickly.
Seems like you have
even
to
if he's got food and water.
It seems like you have to be in a low emotional state then for these things to attach to then too. Because if you have faith in a higher self or a higher power, you're happy with who you are and what you have, then they wouldn't be interested probably. You probably wouldn't taste good to them or whatever, sure. They probably wouldn't feed on you because
it's a defense system. It's like an immune system, like let's say higher self and then lower self, and there's a barrier, but that separates them, and that's the strength of each degree. If you're really really evil, it'll be extremely difficult to convert you to good. If you're really really good, it'll be extremely difficult to convert you to bad. But if you're kind of on the fence, you're fair game.
Interesting.
That's the way I look
at it.
And that's
that's
why I have a lot of faith. Not just faith in myself and faith in humanity and faith in my higher self, really. A little trinity like that. I think it was Anthony Robbins said that America's facing a crisis of faith, not in God, not in the government, but in themselves. And I think when you don't have any faith in yourself, boom, you're prey.
Yeah, I can see that. Very interesting.
Good.
I lost my train of thought. Radio silence. It's deadening. Somebody say something quick.
Ironically, sometimes I get complaints from listeners that sometimes we don't pause enough to let something sink in.
Okay. How long can we go without?
I don't know. Let's have a moment of silence to have the psychopath truth sink in, shall we? And begin. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, you know what, though? But what you said is very interesting because growing up in Los Angeles, I see how vulnerable people are all the time. I think growing up here, I have a base of friends and family that keep me grounded, but I think people that come from different countries and different cities and different states are very vulnerable. You know, we have, you know, to things like religious cults or drugs or being sucked into porn because, they come here with these stars in their eyes and, you know, hope that, you know, they can be famous. And, you know, they don't realize the whole game and they don't realize how much goes into getting to that level. And, you know, they're instantly crushed and they're vulnerable to psychopaths, pedophiles, what have you, you know. And I think it's largely because they don't have that support system when they come out here. You know, they leave their friends and family behind. And
A friend of mine told me over the weekend that when he was pulling security at a hotel in Holland, I think, in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. He saw these Israelis who would find these girls, like 19, 20-year-old girls, you know, the first time ever traveling overseas, and they grab them and they tell them, you know, we'll protect you, we're going to be really nice to you, we're going to take care of you, and all of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Human traffickers, right?
Oh.
You know what? Yeah, that's what happens. He'll see them like a month later, and they'll be addicted to heroin on the streets or standing on one of the bridges over the canal about to commit suicide.
Jesus.
You know? Real, real bad people. And he tried to warn some of these girls, you know? These guys will take you. They'll kidnap you. And they'll sell you into the sex trade. Some of them take the hint and then walk. Some of them don't, and they're never seen again. You know, and the Israelis will come up to him and take a knife out and press it to his throat, and you keep your freaking mouth shut, boy. You know, these people.
Oh God!
Oh yeah. The thing is, the movies can never ever convey how terrifying it is to actually have your life in danger by a psychopath who would just as soon kill you as look at you.
Well, and in fact, I would say it desensitizes you to that because when you talk to people about these things that go on, they don't believe you because they saw it in a movie and they think it can't possibly happen. It's a movie, you know? I saw that in a movie, so that's not real. You know, things like this don't go on.
Right. There's a thing called predictive programming, which is being exposed nowadays, isn't it? And I think that's actually quite a brilliant thing to do, is put in front of people what you're planning to do ahead of time, but keep it in the fictional context. That way, if anybody sees what you're really doing, they'll think it's fiction.
But can people also take that message and figure out what people are doing and turn it the other way as well?
Yeah, well, every brilliant scheme is its own sows the seeds of its own demise, I think.
Because I was watching the Olympics. Whatever. What's the difference?
What's the difference?
What's the difference?
Well, you know, the Olympians survive the events for one.
Right. Yeah.
That's or do I, they? Or
no, actually. Beyond the Olympians surviving, it's really no different to the Hunger Games. It's all about advertising, entertaining the crowds, and distracting them from the fact that everybody's a freaking slave.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was thinking, I got into a debate with my brother because I was like, oh, we're in the Hunger Games right now, man. He's like, oh, that's stupid. Like, you know, that's not. I was like, no, but you can tell. Really, I would say that in the movie compared to now, it's very exaggerated, but we are living in... We're not physically killing and eating each other, but we are living in that kind of world, right? Where we worship people and we're worshiping the wrong things. We're worshiping money. We're materialistic and we're sacrificing our lives. Not physically, but in the sense where we're working ourselves to death, you know, to pay for iPhones and cars and stuff that we don't need, you know, and we're basing our self-worth on that. We're idolizing people and putting them up on pedestals, you know, with all the celebrities and stuff like that. So
I think that's what Edward Bernays taught in his advertising and propaganda campaigns, is to make people feel like buying something will make you feel good. That this is the only, this is the last thing you will need to buy, and then you will achieve happiness. Ironically, you can never achieve happiness by buying things, not permanently anyway. You need a constant situation. And you know what's really irritating is that with planned obsolescence, not only do you think that buying things makes you happy, but they keep breaking, and you have to keep buying them!
You're like, oh, my iPhone broke, I'm sad, I'll just buy another one so I can be happy.
Right.
That one breaks. You know, so it's like you're on this emotional roller coaster, you know?
Or they get a new one so fast, you know, and then you gotta have the new one because the one you've got is now obsolete, you know, and this one's got, is faster, it's like it's 2.02 seconds faster.
There's this picture or post that somebody put up around Christmas, and it said, did you see that? It said, my mom is so stupid. She bought me the iPad 2, but I wanted the iPad 3. And then somebody wrote below it, kill yourself now, you spoiled. I'm not going to suppose to get on your show, Anthony. I feel bad. But it's this materialism, especially just being a teacher and seeing it with the kids, it drives me crazy.
One
drives
word.
Drives me insane.
Soullessness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's basically part of the agenda of materialism, don't you think? Is to detach you, your physical being, from your material soul.
Yeah. Have you seen that movie, documentary, Born Rich?
No.
No, it's about Jamie Johnson, who's an heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune. He makes a documentary about kids in the 1920s. He goes around and interviews them. They're heirs to, you know, great fortune. And none of them are really happy.
Mm.
And it's very interesting. The only two that see, I mean, not that I know them personally, but I got that none of them are really, really happy. The only two, or maybe it's two, I would say two maybe, that were happy were the people that were actually going out and giving back. You know, they actually went somewhere away from their money, and they lived in nature for a while, or they lived in a different country, but not like in a resort. You know, they actually worked with people, or were giving back, or learned a skill, or learned how to do something. They seemed to have more substance in their life, but other kids were just drinking, getting drunk, shopping, you know, and they just seemed so, you know, they didn't have, like, soulless. Not that they were bad people. I don't think they were bad people. They just seemed so unfulfilled. And it's interesting how, I just thought when I was watching that, how, you know, we're taught to believe if we get those things, then we'll be happy. But then they have those things, and they're still not happy. So then what? And people were very upset, you know, that he made that movie. And I'm just like, well, maybe they realize, you know, or once the masses realize that being rich, you know, isn't the way to happiness, then that whole facade's going to be gone. And it's no, you know, you can't buy people, or you can't convince people that materialism is the road to happiness.
I think you're right. The only reason why people should want to be rich and powerful is to have enough resources to help people who cannot help themselves. I mean, everybody can help themselves to a degree, but there's certain things that you can't help yourself with. All right. You know, let's say you don't have a home and you're freaking homeless and you don't have a job. Somebody needs to give you a job. Somebody needs to find you a home, because you've got no ability to do it for yourself at that point. You know, those kind of things is where I think power and wealth traditionally should lie in. And it is in the power to do good that the wealthy should really be focusing their attentions, not on the power to amass more power or the wealth to amass more wealth, because that's like a snake eating itself. What does it amount to? Nothing. This is the problem, because I want power, I want wealth, and I want it for two reasons. Number one, the reason why I want power is because I know so many activists who don't have anybody to protect them when the law comes down on them for exposing scumbaggery. I want the power to be able to protect those people against the government, against gangs, against goons, perhaps even against the military, you know? Because these people have military intelligence, people following them and whatnot. What if I could just pass them a phone or a detector or something like that so that they could surveil their frequencies and they could actually surveil their surveillance and know what they're up to and play mind games with them? What if everybody just needed one bit of technology or something like that to make their enemy's life a living hell and make their job very difficult indeed? I would love the power and the resources to be able to give that to people. And the form in which I hope to accomplish that is by giving people media coverage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being in the media is a powerful position, and power connotes much responsibility or it connotes corruption. You're either responsible or you're corrupt. I don't think there's any in-between on this, eh?
No, there isn't. I don't think so either.
And I think if you want somebody who is powerful to not become corrupted, they need to be kept in check by people all around them that are on an equal footing, okay? Because my great fear is that my lust for power and control to do good would suddenly go to my head, and I would use that power and control to subvert people, destroy lives, and force people to do what I want instead of persuading them.
Mm. Hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting. But you, Vinny, though, you shocked me when you said that you actually prayed for something bad to happen to you when you felt yourself getting into that position where you were kind of like living a little too easy. I'd never heard anyone say that in my entire life.
I know.
Someone pray for something bad to happen to you. It's like,
please, a hurricane, a type something, a demon, right. Something, like whatever, you know.
And then it came true because then they shut off your PayPal or something like that. Yeah. I was like, wow, okay. I've never prayed for anything bad, but, you know, because we don't usually, you know. But, I mean, the whole thing with going back to the idea of having possessions, and I think we were talking earlier about comedy and about comedians and things like that, and I don't know if you've seen the comedian Louis C.K. was talking about how, you know, we have everything and everything is fantastic. There's all this technology, but yet nobody's happy. Yeah. Do you remember that? Yeah. And yeah, I thought that was that, you know, the comedians tend to have, they tend to be kind of truthers if they're really good, and they can kind of show the reflection on either on society or, you know, politics or whatever it be, but and kind of show us, you know, what we are. And it's really true, because do you ever see people, you know, complaining about their phone or complaining about these like minute little things? And you know, what was the example I guess? They say, oh, they go, oh, I hate Verizon. Verizon sucks, you know, and they're like all complaining about it, oh, you know. I mean, yeah, I'm sure for some people who don't have food, it sucks to not have food, you know. Yeah. Whereas you're just complaining about Verizon. So it's but it's not those possessions, it's our relationships. And I think for Steen and I, you know, getting into the media, that is part of what has spurned our interest, was actually to be able to be a part of a community and to connect with other people like-minded, and so we could form our own tribe and our own community of us, you know, tinfoil hat wearers, us conspirators.
Or our own New World Order reptilian slang army. You know, if you want to think
exactly.
About that.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
It's because that's, you know, what we want.
Oh, you really got to pay attention to yourself, you know, and it's not like, oh, it's all about me, me, me. It actually is all about me, 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 but it's, what am I actually doing? Am I actually helping? And am I even happy? Okay?
Yeah.
That's the me, me, me that you should be thinking about. Instead of me, 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 what am I accumulating? How am I capable of manipulating people in order to obtain that? And how can I get away with it?
Right.
And how can I live with myself?
Mm. Yeah, and it...
Now, we were talking before about comedians, and I was just thinking about this. When I was listening to Bill Hicks, and I told you in that interview with me that I credit him largely with my wake-up, because it's kind of the first truth of material I came across to a degree. And I found I was never traumatized by listening to Bill Hicks, because he was telling you the truth, the scary truth.
Right.
But frick, it was funny, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I also told you during that interview that this show is not about trying to wake people up. It's not for the uninitiated. This is for people who have already woken up and gone through all that trauma and the pain of waking up and what have you, and then just trying to inject a little bit of comedy into it so that you can, you know, prevent yourself from going freaking nuts. And I think that it's not traumatic because it's funny. Now, Maybe because I don't want to try and wake people up per se and be all professional about it and very, you know, serious and just not funny. Then maybe I'm actually waking up people anyway and waking them up in a way that's not traumatic so that they can easily adjust their lives from being a stupid, mindless, retarded slave to being a mindful, wise, caring and eclectically educated individual.
Right. That's true. Do you know Joy Camp?
Yes, I've interviewed them on the show.
Oh, you have? We have a story. All right. Here
they're
it goes.
Great, eh?
Yeah, no, we, well, you know, first, we forgot to mention, we started this show when I was living in Taiwan. And, April and I started the show and we're like, we came across their videos and we got in touch with them. We found out that we went to the same college. As April and I were leaving, they were coming in, and April was a screenwriting or writing major, and Kevin was a writing major, and Benny was acting emphasis, and I was acting emphasis. We literally like left each other within, I don't know, the year, right? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe even before that, so we could have even ran into each other or been around each other, but not have known who we were.
Right. Yeah, we had these parallels with these guys, and we felt very like we appreciate their art and the way that they approach it with a sense of humor, and they use their talents and the things that they have. And I think that, you know, it's something that we kind of try to do too, because we don't want to. It's painful to be serious all the time. I mean, do you ever get, Vinny, like the people who tell you you need to be more serious? You need to be like a serious journalist. Do you get that sometimes?
One of my listeners, Vince, actually asked me that in the car, and he says, "Why don't you be serious?" And I mean, like what? Like everybody else? Can you tell me, bro? Name me one show that you can hear of in New Zealand that's talking about conspiracy stuff and is talking about it with a light sense of humor. In fact, tell me any person who's doing a couple of hours a day, 5 days a week, who's doing serious conspiracy stuff and that does it purely from a comedy sense of view. But of course, obviously, there's the information and introspection and all of that. He couldn't think of one, and so I was asking, why is it that I should be and do everything everybody else does? That is, you know, look.
Right.
They want to put you into a format, okay? There's certain people in this world who just love telling everybody else who's creative to follow certain little rules. They've followed those little rules all their life, which is the reason why they got no creativity left, so they have to impose those rules on you to destroy yours.
Yeah, and they don't even realize they're doing it, though, too. They think they're being helpful, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. That's the thing that you've got to realize about life in general. You really have to do things your own way. If you've got a vision, if you have purpose, if there is meaning in what you do, and people try to dissuade you from doing it, you're going to balls it up. I've seen it happen to so many people. Too much advice. You don't even do any of your thinking for yourself anymore. It becomes somebody else's show. It's not your way of doing it. And if you're not doing it your way, you're not going to be happy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You know, like we've had opportunities to do writing for other people, and they say, "Well, you know, but you have to use my format, or you have to do it in such a way." Well, I don't do that. You know, I write from a certain perspective, and it's usually personal and kind of introspective, and I talk about my own experience because, you know, I'm not. There's a lot of people who do a lot of really great research, and that's their journey. But it's not mine. You know, I'm kind of living the journey that I'm on, you know, and through my experiences with my son and my vaccine, you know, what we've experienced through his vaccine damage, I have enough to pull from to write about. And that's, you know, that's my voice. That's what I have to do. And I don't, other people can do that and that's fine. You know, they want to go out and just have a ton of citations and a ton of research. I write the way that I do.
Which and we don't do. Do you use studies?
I mean, I've done the research, but I just don't necessarily need to feel the need to give people citations for everything that I'm saying, because I've also experienced it firsthand in life. So that to me is, you know, if they don't want to believe it, then that's up to them. You know, that's not my problem, really. You know.
Yeah, I was totally giving you stuff. I was messing because we're joking, you know. But there are people that would say stuff like, "Oh, well, there are no studies that show." Well, I mean, how do you think scientists get studies from other people's personal experiences or the information for other studies?
Yeah.
So that kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, about the appeal to authority, where people need to need someone to tell them how to think and what to think.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that's one of the things that happened to me on the weekend. One of my listeners told me, I meet up with my listeners. Every time I go to a music gig or anything, there's always listeners of mine there, eh? Because my listeners are all very, very cool people, I've found. Every single one I've met has been relatively cool. And what he was telling me is that he uses fallacies, okay? He's a philosophy student. I know about the logical fallacies and what have you, and I try to give him an Ayn Rand quote, you know, how she says, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. He cuts me off halfway through the sentence and just starts saying that she sounds crazy or she looks like a robot and then he said, well, I know it's ad hominem and what have you, but I said, ad hominem's a fallacy. And he goes, yeah, I know, I'm a philosophy. I did a philosophy paper. I know all about logical fallacies. Yeah, but you continue to use them.
Mm.
Fallacy comes from the Latin fallare, which means to lie. It means that not only do you know that these are lies, but you continue to lie, even after you're aware of them.
Well, it's like the light side or the dark side of the force. You can use these to empower yourself or other people, and you can use them to manipulate people.
Exactly. And he went on to say that, but there needs to be some kind of authority. You know, we need it. But appeal to authority is a logical fallacy too, and that's just a lie. Okay. Yeah. So like you really have to convince people. Through very, very simple understandings, if they're educated. It's funny, the more educated you are, the
stupider you are?
No. Well, to a degree, are, I mean. it's more like your intelligence gets warped to work against reason rather than be backed up by it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think I talked about this somewhere. One of our shows, we were talking about this. I was looking at the Quack Watch. Are you familiar with Quack Watch page? Quack Watch?
You mean the ones who say every time somebody gets saved by some natural remedy that's been used for thousands of years or has 70 years of peer-reviewed studies and Nobel Peace Prize winners behind it, that it's all quackery and is evil, and therefore all those people that are pushing it are real quacks and evil and should be locked down in prison and their practices shut down.
Yes, but this guy, I'm looking at the guy that runs, you can say it better, Benny, I'm looking at the guy that runs Quack Watch, and he has all of these awards and recommendations and certificates. I was like, but yeah, he's never cured anybody from cancer or, you know, any other disease. And it's funny, though, because I've known people that have searched, you know, they've had some kind of ailment, and then I'll give them, like, a doctor to, like, Dr. Mercola, right? And they'll put in Dr. Mercola, and then Quack Watch will come up. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, Dr. Mercola isn't a real doctor because it says so on Quack Watch. I'm like, well, he's cured cancer, so who are you going to believe, the guy with, like, the 25 certificates? Or you're going to believe the dude that actually cured cancer? Like,
I love that, eh? Like, Cancer Society, you know, you go to they do their donation drives every year, you know. In New Zealand, we have Daffodil Day. You know, daffodil flower is quite pretty, you know. And they hand out these plastic daffodils to everybody, and they take your money. And they've existed for 20 years, and you go up and you ask them, so how long's the Cancer Society been around? Oh, about 20 years. And how many times have they cured somebody of cancer? None. And how many cures for cancer have they come up with so far? None? No. Okay, well, if you were a builder and you told me that you've been building stuff for 20 years and actually haven't built a single thing, then I think you're a scam artist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know what's worse? Is that they use people as their frontline, you know, donation drivers who have had somebody in their family die of cancer. So that way, if somebody comes up to you and says that there are cures for cancer and the Cancer Society ain't doing anything about it, they won't listen to you and get angry with you and tell you to bugger off.
Yeah, right. And then they'll make you feel bad saying that you're like anti-science or, you know, anti-cancer because you're just being a mean, heartless person.
Yeah, I'm anti-science because I verify things with scientifically peer-reviewed articles and people and people who are Nobel Peace Prize winners and so on and so forth. I don't understand the mentality, but I guess that's just because I'm not retarded.
Well, they don't want to listen. You know, people don't want to listen to you. They know everything. And there's nothing, you know, that's the mentality. There's nothing that you can tell them that they don't already know. They've already made up their mind about what they think about what you have to say. Therefore, they don't feel they have to listen. Like we talked about Andrew Wakefield before, and he was on an interview one day and he was talking about the situation that happened to him. And then a doctor came up to him, was like yelling and screaming at him. And he was like, well, did you even read my paper? And the doctor was like, well, I don't need to. Well, how are you going to like attack somebody on their views if you haven't even read what they wrote? That's just so stupid. You know, right. He's a doctor, but he's retarded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, totally.
So.
Yeah,
yeah. Hello. Hello. My name is Dr. Retarded. I'm here to give you a vasectomy.
Oh, no.
Dude, Dr. Retarded and his scalpel are going nowhere near my boys, okay?
Yeah.
Right.
Tell me about it.
Right. Yeah, because they can't come up with it. I mean, they can't. And like you brought up the point of how they use family members, they'll parade these people, which is really sick, to be honest. You know, these people who have lost loved ones. And it's hard for them to hear you say, well, there's a natural cure, because then they think, well, you know, I let my family member die and I didn't even know that there was a cure. You know, that's what's going on internally through them. And, I was telling Christine this earlier, is that I had actually lost a friend because she cut me off because of my views on 9/11. That really upset her, and she never wanted to talk about it or say anything. And you know, I she lived in New York at the time, and I think that, you know, she just kind of knew people who had friends of families and things like that who had been killed. But it kind of was surprising to me, because I'm going, well, wouldn't you want to know the truth of like how they died? Wouldn't that sort of be something you'd be interested in and wanting to maybe? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can understand that being a painful experience from the beginning, but then once you kind of get past that and you can sort of say, okay, well, let me look at this. I want the people who actually did this, not the people who, you know, these box cutter carriers. I don't even know what that crazy story is.
just to play a little devil's advocate, I think it's, I think for them, it's like a double betrayal.
Yeah,
because
sure.
It's like, first of all, the person I love was killed. Second of all, I was betrayed by my country and people that I trusted.
Well,
it's
that's
like
a good
too much, maybe, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point that people bring up. But there have been people in the 9/11 truth movement who have lost family members, and they
Guess who started the 9/11 truth movement? Hello, you. The family members who were unhappy with the BS investigation where the people who committed the crime and appointed all the commissioners, and even though they did that, 6 out of 10 of them said it was BS. Okay, yeah. Come on, people. You've got to be freaking kidding me. Right. You know, hear what it is. It's brain box syndrome. Okay, you know, this cognitive dissonance thing where you can't accept something psychologically, because I liken it to somebody building your mind and reality the same way one would build a house with your own bare hands. You have that a lot of attachment to this thing that you've built, your perception of reality. And how devastating is it to see your house burned down, know that you've got no insurance, and when you're telling them that 9/11 was an inside job and they've got this whole brain box thing worked out, it's like telling somebody to burn down their own house that they built with their bare hands because it's rickety and dangerous and it's going to kill them, and they have to sacrifice and give up all of that. Mm. Barely anybody will. They'll go back and they'll shut the door in your face, and they'll live in that house until it crumples in and crushes them and they die.
Mm. Right. Mm.
Yeah, well.
So why do some people go on to question it? You know, like how do the family members that do start that movement and are asking these types of questions. How do they do it? How are they willing to just rebuild their house?
Two you words. Know what I mean? Moral obligation.
Mm.
You know, it's my favorite two words of all time, I guess. Because they make you do really stupid things for really good reasons. That's moral obligation in a nutshell.
Hmm.
Right. It's like when you left your job, Vinny. And then we had a guy on our show, Clint Richardson, who was working in Hollywood as a sound designer. And he had a moral obligation. He felt after a while, you know, because what he was doing was he was creating these sounds of like monsters and things like that. And he told us how they create those is that they'll actually record the sound of castrating a pig. You know, they'll record real living things in
being pain. Like dismembered. Yeah. And
mm-hmm, exactly. It's terrible. And so, right. And so he had a crisis of conscience doing this, even though he was making a lot of money, because he realized that, you know, this was sort of affecting people's psyches and they were putting this stuff out there. And, you know, and so I think that's a good point that you bring up, you know, because you think about the family members that created the group Building What about the World Trade Center 7, you know, Building 7. It's like those are all family members, and though their families, the people that died in that building, then they would just ignore them and they just act like it doesn't exist. That must be a horrible feeling. You know?
Yeah. I once got assaulted on Queen Street for speaking out for the 9/11 by families by somebody who told me I was being insensitive to them for speaking out about them.
Right, but that's my point. Yeah. Is that how's that insensitive if you're actually trying to defend them? You're trying to, you know, bring the people to justice who actually did it and not these, you know, whatever fairy tale that they're talking about.
That's like somebody, there's like a white guy walking out and going, justice for the black population. And then a white guy coming up to him going, you're racist.
Yeah.
Maybe and then smacking him for it.
Yeah. It's so, yeah.
Again, I love this word retarded almost as much as I love the words moral obligation. In fact, it is a moral obligation to not be freaking retarded. And I'm not talking about like actually having problems and things of this nature. In common usage of the word retarded, it just basically means foolish. Okay, somebody who's so dumb, that so foolish that they're basically incapable of anything that you would actually expect of an adult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you get people who say, oh, you shouldn't use that word, or you shouldn't use certain words of certain language because it's offensive?
Well, I could think up of three swear words that rhyme with FCC. All right. Now, I just want to say, F you to the FCC. Mm-hmm. F you to restricting people's language. Okay? Look, it's words. They don't hurt. They don't destroy things. Okay? Like, I could use the worst language ever at my computers. And when they're fracking up, oh, yes, I do. But they don't get destroyed. And they don't get emotionally beat up about it, right? And look, if you're over 18, frickin' handle it like an adult, okay?
Well, that, you know, that kind of goes back to that whole, like, responsibility thing we were talking about earlier, right? Like, honestly, I would say words are very powerful, and they are important, and I think you should watch. I don't think you should restrict people's language, but I think it's gotten to the point, too, where, you know, parents need to have the relationship with their children where, you know, they can't shield their children from hearing like certain words. So they need to have the relationship or the talk with their children about the power of words and when to use them. Right. But if the FCC is getting to the point where, you know, the FCC has to restrict certain things because of that, it's like the parent's not taking responsibility for their child. They're having somebody else. They want somebody else to be responsible.
Yeah. You know what political correctness is about? One thing and one thing only. Stopping people from saying what they really think.
Yes, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
I think that's basically the end of the story there. If that's the only reason for it to exist, don't think it should exist anymore, eh?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going back to the comedian thing, because I think comedians are often really, you know, they're big proponents of, you know, being able to use their speech, because then if you can't use, say, the language that you want, then you aren't as funny sometimes. And there's this comedian called Nick Swartzen who talks about the words gay and retarded, and he said that he uses these words all the time when he's on stage. And after one of his shows, this woman came up to him. She's like, stop. Don't do that. Don't use those words. Those words are hurtful, you know. And he was like, come on, it's just a word, you know, and I'm not really that smart, so I only have a limited vocabulary. I use what I said. Anyway, it's a really funny piece.
You know what Bill Burr would say to that woman? What are you, a fag?
But aren't you a gay retard? That's what I would have said.
No. You know what you say? It's like on, what's his name? Mark Dice, he goes around talking to black people, and he's talking about the two different versions of the N-word, you know? One is racist, and one is just, you know, you're my N-word. And I can't even say it on the show, man, because the FCC, she are Muslim. And expectedly, every black person knew precisely what he was talking about and gave him the N-word pass. He was able to say it, you know?
It's Louis C. We keep going back to Louis C.K., man, but we have to. But he talks about like how people say the N-word, and how, you know, he has this whole funny bit talking about it and how it makes you like it still makes you think the N-word in your head, you know. Yeah. Or basically, it just goes back to what you're saying. It's just it's keeping people from saying what they really mean. But I hate it. Like I'll say it on our show because. You know, I'll respect your show, but I'm not afraid of that word. I don't like, as a black person, having to be afraid. And I also think it seems like it's some kind of a program. So if somebody calls me that, I'm immediately expected to lose my flippin' mind and act inappropriately.
I found it's really funny. You can't actually say a racial slur to a white person and have them be offended. Have you noticed that?
I'm really offended, Clarence. Some black person called me a cracker.
Well, you have to hit it in their ethnic group. So if they're Jewish, if there's a specific word for Jewish people or for Irish people or, you know, something like that, I think it hits a little closer to the core. Like honky doesn't cut it.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
cracker or honky, it's laughable. But I think you actually calling white people racist, I think that gets more white people upset than even if they are really racist, like that's more offensive to, you know, you call them racist. I've seen white people cry over that. I have. Because they're like, I'm not a racist. I voted for Obama.
Oh, no.
I get money through the United Negro College Fund. Who do you think I am?
Oh, my goodness.
I've seen that. I swear to God.
What do you mean? You voted for Obama, who doubled funding to Planned Parenthood and executed twice as many black babies before they were born, yo. You racist ass, man. You got to have that cracker guilt. I'm a kill you, fool.
Yeah, I know. It's true, though. It's like, that's what you do. You call the racist, and that's the racial slur for white people is racist.
Here's how I convey racism and everything else in language. Am I intending to offend somebody? Am I actually deliberately insulting them? Yes? Then be offended. Am I not intending to insult you? Is there no malice involved in the words that I'm saying? Then don't be offended. Grow up.
There are people that want to be offended, though. You know, there are people that are always looking to be offended, too. And I'm over those people.
Look, those people will go away as soon as you produce a 9mm pistol, all right? Stop telling me what to do, yo. Okay, I'm out of here.
It's so funny.
Unfortunately, I'm not armed, so I do have to deal with those kind of people by blocking them on Facebook. It's like, I don't know. Maybe this is a bit disgusting, girls. But I'm not sure if you had this experience, but when you're a teenager, and even sometimes nowadays, you get them on occasion. You get this real big, juicy, fat pimple or something like that, and that satisfaction that you get when it pops and just goes everywhere. You know, like ah ha ha, yeah, yeah. That kind of sick sensation. It's really kind of disgusting. I get the same sensation when I block people who are douchebags.
It's great. Yeah, because Popping it's like the, they want to write you and they're like type. Oh, I'm blocked. Oh, you're like, oh, you know, you right. like mute them. And then yeah. they have to go out and like kick a cat or something, you know, whatever. Whatever, because obviously that, honestly, it's hard not to take it personally, but when I've gotten sucked into that at the end of the day, I have to really remember it's really not about me. If they're that mean and that vindictive, because we were also talking about like some of these Facebook pages that people put up just to make fun of people, not trying to get to understand them or where they're coming from, but just to make fun of them. What kind of pathetic life is that? You know?
Have no life, so therefore I need to make sure that the people who do currently have a life have less of one, so they're bound to my little level and make me feel better about myself. It's kind of like I did this great post on Facebook about atheists. I mentioned on your show that I have a lot of arguments with feminists and how they invariably all argue the exact same way, nastily, and invariably are all single. Much like atheists, every time I argue with them, they're very, very mean, insulting. They use ad hominem attacks quite a bit, and it's almost like they don't believe in a higher self, so they need to act like a lowlife and speak down to you in order to feel okay with it.
Well, it's, in some ways, their dogma is very religious, you know, because they don't know everything, but then they seem to know that there isn't a God. Well, how do you know
that?
Oh,
they know science, though. They know science.
Well, right. Or, yeah, they believe in that religion, right, or what people call science. And so, but you know, that's like a very dogmatic belief, is to sit there and go, or very, you know, in a lot of ways, they're very pious. And they can be like, well, you believe in a higher power, so therefore, you know, you must be stupid.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Because right. there's no scientific, biological proof, and there have been no studies on God. So, because I can't read the studies on God, you're stupid.
And I love the...
and I'm better than you.
Yeah, and I love the new ages too, who believe there's no such thing as good and evil. And I go, really? When was the last time you killed a child and with malicious intent? Well, I never have. Have you ever beaten anybody up for no reason and just taken the money? No, I haven't done that. What do you do for a living? Well, I make really good health products and send them out to people at a fair and reasonable price. If you don't believe in good and evil, then why are you living good, you douchebag?
I have a question, though. Do you think that the global elites think that they're evil, though? Is it? I'm just playing devil's advocate a little bit because I'm like, are they saying that the people that are doing bad things to us, they don't think that they're evil, or they're just saying that there's no evil?
No. They think they have to do what they're doing. They believe that we are so incapable of taking care of ourselves that they have to take care of every aspect of our lives. All right? They think what they're doing to us is good for us. They think poisoning us is good for us, killing us is good for us, enslaving us is good for us, surveilling everything we do is good for us, and turning us into low IQ, infertile slave scum is good for us and good for the planet. And they believe that they're doing the right thing. Many terrible things have been done throughout history in the name of doing the right thing. And I think that's why a lot of truthers that I've met have become... they've gone over to the dark side. You know what I'm saying? Like in the Star Wars sense of the word?
Yeah, no, totally. Where they think that they've just got rid of these certain group of people, right?
What's insanity? What's insanity? It's not believing in everything that everybody else can see. You know, that's what insanity is. And this is what I believe the elite are. They believe they're doing the right thing because they're completely insane.
Right.
Got you. So going back to the new age, so are you, I was asking, so does they just don't, they believe there's no such thing as evil, period?
No. It's, or they're just, do you know what the definition of solipsism is?
No, would you please let me know?
Okay,
please,
you've heard of the Big Bang, how it created everything out of nothing? Okay,
yeah.
That's basically solipsism in a nutshell, except the person who's perceiving everything in the entire frickin' universe is their own creation. I create absolutely everything, and nothing else, nothing exists. That's the philosophy in a nutshell. Doesn't that sound totally insane to you?
Right.
And not, yeah, yeah. And not to mention, it's really stupid too, because it's like, I create everything. Yeah, but bro, aren't there like 7 billion other people? Are you saying that none of them create anything except you? You know, I mean, it's just even simple logic, you know. Oh, what you resist persists, really. When was the last time you got shot at and didn't shoot back, you know? something right. like that. What you resist actually is what your power comes from. I don't think people realize this, but there's two ways of gaining power for yourself. One is by resisting people who want to take something from you, and the other is by creating something that doesn't yet exist from nothing, you know, like a guy who invents a radio or a light bulb or a television or an iPhone or something like that, actually came up with the original idea and then used this physical 3D realm and the resources available within it to manifest it into reality. Now, those things that we manifest into reality, I think, are actually far more powerful than any prayer or spiritual belief in many, many ways, because they can affect the entirety of the spectrum. All right, you know, like what it is to be human is about being physical, spiritual, and mental. Okay, I'm especially mental, and what we got is an ability to bring something into the physical realm that can actually in some cases affect both the spiritual and mental realms. All right. I don't know many things about the spiritual or mental realms that are capable of actually affecting the two other elements with such ease. There are things that you can do, like you can practice, and apparently some people are telekinetic and what have you after they've been meditating for 60 years or whatever. But if I wanted to move a chair, as Alan Aberdesagreen told me, I would move the chair, not meditate for 60 years so I didn't have to move it with my hands.
So so that's a good point. You know, a lot of it, I mean, because how can you be controlling of it, of the reality everywhere all over the world, and then there's all these other people, so you would have to almost think that no one existed but you, right?
That's exactly what solipsism is.
So it's like extreme egocentric.
No, it's universal egocentricity. All right, I'm not just me and everything's about me. It's I am the universe, all of it, everything in it, and I control it all like a god.
Right.
You know? Oh, that's called acid.
Yeah. it's funny because before you said acid, I was about to say tripping balls, which is incidentally what you do while on acid. Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, yeah, and back to the point of comedians. I got interviewed by Dr. Bill Deagle this one time on the Genesis Network, I think, and he said that the two most intelligent professions, like the ones with the highest IQ, are theoretical physicists and comedians.
Mm.
The ability to make theoretical connections that work in a very solid and rigid form. More or less, is the baseline of intelligence for both of those fields. One is about understanding; they're both about understanding complex systems and simplifying them so that they can be used for something.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating. That's great.
It is, yeah.
And it makes the comedians. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, because we're always talking about comedians, how they're awake, and it's because of, you know, we believe it's their job to observe society, but also to have like the interconnections within themselves and the to see how it relates to them and the courage to be able to admit it, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's the good ones too.
Hmm?
Yeah,
I meant like the good ones, not necessarily every comedian.
Yeah, no, the good ones.
Yeah.
Well, the ones that are really funny.
The ones that are already dead.
Laugh so hard your stomach, like, you know, splits.
Yeah. The ones that are already dead, in other words. And
the dead ones, only the dead ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Have you noticed that the live artists and things like that will never ever measure up to the dead ones? It's because the dead ones can't answer back, and it's like, you know, if a modern orchestra or conductor or something like that came up with something better than Mozart or whatever, Mozart's not around to say, oh, nah, that's chicken shit, bro. I'll just do this. I'll suss it. I'll make a way better symphony. No, it doesn't happen, eh? So therefore, we're relegated to respect those who have died and come before us, because at the end of the day, anybody who comes up with any great art form nowadays, I don't think it's entirely original, because it's all based upon what art they've seen, how it makes them feel, that you always see these influences and elements from other things that are going in there. And in such a way, we've got this historical context by which we can follow art forms, whether it's a comedy going back to, what's his name? There's Greek comedy plays and things like that thousands of years ago. And allegedly there's only something like 7 different storylines. And apparently today, if you apply those basic plot storylines to every single Hollywood film, there are none of them that fall outside of it or something like that, or very few. Right. Mm-hmm. So the way that we make art doesn't change. It's only what the art looks like and what the end product is.
Mm-hmm. Right, we have different tools to express it, you know, photography, or you have, you know, because at one point everything was, you know, there was no such thing as a camera, right? So everything was a painting.
You had to paint and draw.
Right, exactly. You had to draw or paint. And so, yeah, and right, and even that, you know, took materials. At one point, you know, my son likes to do this thing where he takes blueberries and he smears them on the wall. It's like a form of cave art, right? So you had, at one point, they would just take whatever materials they had, be it flowers or fruit or something, and just smear it on the wall and so on and so forth. So it's like the technology that changes, not the art.
So from blueberries to like Photoshop now, right?
It's like, exactly. Yeah.
Well, so it means that the human ability to produce art is only limited by our technology, and our technology is only limited by our creativity. All right? And there are no limits to creativity. Not in my opinion, anyway. I could be wrong.
No, they're not. No. No, I mean, you're right.
You know,
right.
Maybe somebody will come up with a mathematical formula like all human creativity and the ability to come up with anything original and anything new will stop at, like, I don't know, 2150 or something like that. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. And this is why I never believe in the end of the world stuff. You know, like people going on about 2012, they're going about Y2K, they're going about Nostradamus or whatever his name was. And
I was into that until after Y2K. After Y2K, I was like, I was done.
Yeah. See, yeah. People were asking me during 2012, what do you think is going to happen? Well, it's either one of three things. It's either the prophesized return of the destroyer that's in the Bible and everybody's fracked, or it's a some ridiculous consciousness shift or whatever, and we turn into fifth dimensional beings and we transcend time and space and we all float away like a bunch of ghosts into space. Or three, it's a completely made up myth to distract everybody with a whole bunch of fear paradigm BS so that they can get away with a whole bunch of more scumbaggery in the meantime while you're distracted by an end of the world that ain't coming. And even well before 2012, I was choosing option number three, and it turns out I was correct. So it occurs to me that being utterly cynical whenever it's the end of the world will probably save you. I'm going to be like a perpetual doomsday naysayer, you know. Oh, Comet Ivan's coming. There's going to be 800 kilometer an hour winds from giant cyclones that'll cover half the hemisphere. No, it's not. there's some other freaking thing coming out of this. There's a flying spaghetti monster that shoots vaccines out of its tentacles.
Oh, that was terrible. Oh, my God. I got terrible. An image in my head. That's awful.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
the backseats on the spaghetti and the sauce, like dripping.
It'll be like on it'll be like on Ghostbusters where the demon comes out and asks them to choose their fate, and he chooses the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. This flying spaghetti monster that shoots mercury vaccines out of its spaghetti testicles. What did I say? Testicles on it. I'm sorry.
Oh no. FCC.
I wonder what spaghetti testicles would look like. They're kind of wrinkly.
Oh my god, I'm gonna have nightmares tonight.
Christine, what is it? I was having dreams about the giant flying spaghetti monster testicles.
Do you think that I heard David Icke and some analysts that have been talking about like this is coming, like awakening or of consciousness. Do you see that? What are your thoughts on that? What do you think about that?
Do I see it, a huge mass awakening of consciousness? In terms of...
I guess you'd say like between like now and 2016.
I hate coming up with I don't agree with that whatsoever. If anything, people are becoming dumber and dumber and sheepisher and sheepisher, and then there's a splinter fraction of humanity that's doing the direct opposite. They're becoming smarter and smarter and well more protected from vaccines and stuff like that, and are taking care of their health, and the rest of the sheep and stuff like that are just basically going to get so dumb that they'll wind up killing themselves through no fault of their own, just through accepting the programming and brainwashing and what have you, and then it'll basically just be left the super psychopathic elite and the super smart, super healthy, good people fighting against each other, you know?
Like chess.
Yeah. I mean, more or less, there's only a certain number of pieces on the board, and at the end of the day, there's only usually a few key pieces that you need to win an entire game in a lot of cases. So when we're talking about a consciousness shift by what? What did he say? 2020, 2025? Incidentally, that's the date for like implementation of huge amounts of Agenda 21 protocols or whatever. That's when we'll all be living in the slave blocks. That's when we'll be connected with mega highways and what have you. That's when the Fukushima radiation will make the Northern Hemisphere uninhabitable. That's when the chemtrails, that's like 10 years after the chemtrails make the Northern Hemisphere uninhabitable, according to Dane Wigington and so on and so forth. Look. You want to make a prediction, you got to have all available information on the entire planet. You name me one person who's got access to all information on the entire planet at any one time. It's not freaking possible. Predictions based upon very specific things can be made through a much smaller cache of information. You take a look at, what's his name, Gerald Celente. The reason why his Trends Research Journal is so incredible and so credible at the same time as being incredible, ironically enough, is because he only goes for the trends in the economy and things like that, the things he can predict with the available information. Predicting a mass global consciousness shift would require an intense understanding of what consciousness is, how every single person's individual consciousness is currently being affected today, how much technology is being used in order to accelerate this consciousness, the amount of conscious people awake already that are currently spreading and multiplying that consciousness among other people around them, the different philosophies behind each and every single one of these different consciousnesses and exactly how they replicate and going in through it. You see, it's already getting too complicated, and I've only even started the list of the things you would need to know in order to make a prediction like that. The real simple things that we can understand, though, is conspiracy culture is getting a hell of a lot bigger. All right. Now, you would define that as kind of a consciousness shift, wouldn't you? Believing that the police are good to you and now knowing that they're scumbags? You know, or I don't need to throw them under the bus, although they've probably done that to a few pedestrians that they didn't like. You know, he was selling
drugs. Literally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it comes down to that. It's like the tortoise and the hare. The New World Order is the tortoise, and they've started off early, and they've been moving very, very slowly towards the finish line. We're the rabbit that's just woken up. We're right down the end of the track, and we're running for the finish line, just hoping we beat that slow-moving tortoise there just in time. Okay, and I think that's what it comes down to. I like that idea that we're coming to a head that is just in time and what have you, but I've been to far too many protests interviewed far too many people and heard far too many predictions to believe that they'll all make a difference or all come to fruition, or even any of them, for that matter. The fact of the matter is everything's totally unpredictable because everything changes on a minute-to-minute basis. One person gets through a security checkpoint, grabs a microphone and tells everybody to investigate 9/11 on the Super Bowl. Who the frick predicted that would happen?
Right.
You know? And you know what is the great thing about being human is that we've got the ability to plan, scheme, come up with defensive strategies, whether militarily or intellectually or emotionally. There's all these kinds of strategies that we can come up with to change things, invent stuff, and make the world a better place. And I think kind of predicting stuff is almost like throwing that out the window, you know? Assuming no creativity or anything changes from this point on... In 20 years' time, we'll have this consciousness shift. Come on, bro! Come on!
So you're saying you don't know anything, basically. All that long explanation.
I know what's...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm just messing with
point,
you.
Yeah.
I know what has happened in history, and I kind of know a lot of things that are going on now, or at least I know parts of it. Maybe I need to fill in the gaps on occasion and what have you, but nobody knows the future. I do know that everything that I do right at this very second affects my future in some small, insignificant way, like the butterfly effect, you know, a little word in the air or what have you. I mean, I talked on your show about my male mentor, Derek, who kind of, you know, when I was a young boy and I was really violent and stuff like that at school, it kind of, my violence just went away because I had a positive male role model who was really peaceful and a very good dude, right?
Right.
So what if we were to take the influences of the New World Order and turn it against them, the same way my male violence was turned against me when a non-violent male came into it, you know?
Did you ever see the old Disney Sleeping Beauty?
Yeah.
The old one. It's like, remember the fairies? They can never use their powers for bad, but they can turn their powers into someone's bad power into something good. Like if the queen threw arrows at them, they could turn them into flowers or rocks. They would turn them into like bubbles or something like that, right?
Mm. Yeah. I think that's the... That's one of the things about the Jedi that I like the idea of the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy, and that a Jedi uses his skills for knowledge and defense, never for attack. Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think that it would actually be quite cool if our police force had a similar thing like Jedi training, you know?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be choice if there were like these non-violent kind of monks who could kill huge quantities of people at any point if they wanted to, if they were being attacked or threatened or what have you, you know, just these hugely powerful dudes who are so humble and want nothing but to serve humanity, you know?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of powerful people on this world today who do nothing but try and serve humanity. I think they should be respected for that, because I don't know what the balance is, how much power you need, how much self-restraint, how much wealth, how much skills or intelligence or whatever you need to be perfect. I don't really care how much of this, that, or the other. Just try and not be a dick and try and help people who need help. I mean... It boils down to the simplicity at the end of the day. There's so many complex things over there, and it drives you nuts thinking about all the complexity.
Yeah, yes. It can. It can.
It's
definitely.
True. Which, like, that's a good point that you bring up, which makes it impossible to predict because there is so much complexity, and that would assume that you would understand so much of how people think or how much, you know. There's just too many variables to predict how the entire, you know, global consciousness is going to change. You know, you can maybe see a shift. And I think when you're talking about history, that's probably our best predictor, is because history does repeat. So we see that patterns in history of things that happened before, you know, we could compare the United States to Rome. The fall of Rome would happen just before that happened. And say, well, you know, I can kind of see some similarities there. You know.
I remember Ian R. Crane was doing a presentation called What to Do When the Shift Hits the Fan. Mm-hmm. And I said to him he should do a follow-up to that lecture called How to Get Your Shift Together. And what we were really wanting, or at least what I was hoping by this, is people would stop living in anxiety of the future, stop living in fear of something bad about to happen, and stop living in hope of something good to happen. How about you keep your focus here and now, where it belongs, where you can make a difference? Past has already happened. You can't change that. Future hasn't happened yet. So you can do stuff today to affect it. You know, I mean, visionary, right? That's a thing that's been used to describe many people who have changed history for the better. You know, I had a vision. And I think that is still a big part to play here. I mean, you name me one group of people who's really changed everything, and then name me individuals who have changed things by leading groups of people. That's actually traditionally how the change comes, right? So we all naturally appeal to authority. What if it was for a good reason?
Hmm.
All right? Because occasionally, and I think this is why appeal to authority is such a logical fallacy, is because it's not necessarily true. Right? I can't appeal to that authority because just appealing to authority in and of itself doesn't work. It's a fallacy. But if this person here has huge quantities of documents, has power to change the world for the better, isn't just promising things that he can't deliver, and is actually leading people towards a brighter future, then wouldn't that appeal to you?
Mm-hmm.
Now, seeing as that's the difference between you appealing to authority and having an authority that is appealing to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, and then I think, like, when it comes, going back to, like, the whole, end of the world scenarios, you know, I always feel like I don't really understand what that's going to accomplish, you know? When you're saying, oh, well, these things in this amount of time, there's going to be this big catastrophe and all these things. It's like, well, either it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. But I have to live today, as you were pointing out, you know, there are things that you could do right here and now. Because no matter what you do, you're not getting out of this life alive. Okay, one way or another, you're gonna die. So it could be in a catastrophe,
snap. Yeah,
right. Or it could be, you know, after 105 years because you lived a really healthy lifestyle and you took care of yourself, and you know the world didn't end. You know, but or it could happen. So I don't really get the point in kind of thinking about predicting, you know, the end or predicting, you know, what other people are gonna do or things like that. Yeah. It doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, I predict tomorrow the sun will come up. Damn, I'm good.
But if it doesn't, then you're screwed, you know?
No, but I think it's we're all screwed if that happens, so it doesn't matter if I'll be incorrect, because anybody to criticize me and pull me up on it will be dead,
right?
Yeah.
Hence you can't lose if you deny doomsday. You just can't.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You either live and don't live life in anxiety, or you die along with everybody else in peace. You know, there you go.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. It's only going to happen. It's only going to happen one of two ways. So whatever, you know. So exactly.
Extraordinarily, people have lost their ability to want to live. Right, and I think this is on the part of pharmaceutical drugs to a quite extensive degree. What's the number one killer in America, ladies and gentlemen? Drum roll, please. Suicide.
All right.
And what is everybody of those suicidal people actually doing at the time? Taking pharmaceutical drugs. And what's on the warning label of those pharmaceutical drugs? May cause suicide.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just that frickin' simple. To be Jonesian,
the New World Order's got a whole raft of scumbaggery that's working through that medical system, and they're pumping you full of drugs to make you deny reality and try to escape things and make sure that drugs are the only thing that are actually left for you. And I'm sick of it. It's documented. I've got the evidence. I have the documents.
Could you cry too? Would you cry?
I'm just so sad about the new world order. They're gonna take my children and cancel my job. Oh Lord, please help me. I just want to have the strength of God and all the infinite consciousness to defend my family and frick up these frickers of scumbaggery.
He goes to the full range of emotions, that guy. Right,
but no, I have a lot of respect for Alex Jones.
Who do you think woke me up? Who do you think motivated me to become a talk radio show and expose some scumbaggery every day? Here's the thing.
But that's how you know, that's why we're able to do this so well, because you know how he is.
Oh yeah. And I was addicted.
Huh?
I get addicted to it though. For a period of time. I don't really listen to him much anymore. In fact, I had somebody else tell me this the other day. I asked him if he'd seen one of my videos or something, and he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, man. I'm just making so much of my own stuff. I don't have time to watch everybody else's stuff." And I go, "Bro, that is my favorite excuse, and I use it regularly."
But it's true. Same thing with us.
Yeah,
we have, like,
I know.
Video shows and stuff, and we don't really have the time to watch.
I said to my listeners once, I would rather every single one of my listeners stop listening to me and start their own radio show and put me out of business and replace me with tens and tens of thousands of other radio show hosts out there. I would actually prefer that to happen, because at least people are being empowered and they're not listening to somebody else, and they're actually making their own opinions heard, and they're putting their voices out there, and they're exposing quantitatively more scumbaggery than I could expose on my own.
Yeah, that's a good point. We had somebody in our chat room recently, our last show, and I think we had just – we don't watch Alex Jones that much or any of these people really all that much, but we had just mentioned him, and this guy in the chat room was like, "Stop listening to Alex Jones. Don't listen to him." And I think I responded, "Well, we try to listen to a little bit of everything." And he said, "Yeah, but you don't listen to him at all. Don't even talk about him." And I'm like, "God, relax, dude." I mean, what do you think about these people that get all like hopped up on that, and they think that everybody is an agent or everybody's going out there and is secretly working for the New World Order? It's like, I don't know what to do with that information. I'm like, okay, well, you know, we just brought him up. I don't think we were like promoting his show or anything like that. And he was just going,
"And even
no,
if
you can't
we
talk
were,
about
it. Like, but even if we were, like, so what? It's not, you know."
Well, here's what somebody told me once. He doesn't need promotion. He's Alex Jones. Mm-hmm. You know, he got it locked down. He's numero uno. There ain't no arguments about it. He's like number 1,000 of websites in the world, something around that area. With millions upon millions upon millions of views of his documentaries, and all of his listenership all over the place, mass responses, the huge studios, and all of that kind of jazz that he's got, he doesn't need our help to a large degree,
right.
and he can't give any to us, you know, and so there's this disconnect here between what Alex Jones is, what he can do, and then what he's doing it for. And people, because he's accumulated wealth and power as a result of his ridiculously hard work, nobody can deny that, people yeah. think that he's doing it because he's got something to gain. Look, with a voice like that, talent like that, you could be making millions and millions and millions of dollars just doing radio ads for mainstream radio yeah. networks. Easily work a couple of weeks a year tops, you know. He doesn't do that, okay? That's not the entire reason why he's in it. There are many, many, many things that everybody does, and for frack's sake, if you don't know the person very, very well, it's very difficult to criticize, isn't it? Because you don't actually know what you're criticizing, much like a doctor who will come up and flagrantly abuse another doctor who's making something claimed in a paper that doctor has never read.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. I just thought, you know, relax, dude. I mean, it's not like, because I don't even remember what we said, because I wasn't even listening to the show at the time. So, but I guess we had made some kind of mention of him, and he just got so worked up. But I mean, that's a good point. Is like he could be doing all these other things. He could be making. I think that it's indisputable that he works hard, and I think it's indisputable that he's really smart and he remembers things really well, and he has a lot of a lot of good people working for him that are researching really well. Yeah. And that's it. That's all I'm going to say about that. But this guy got all offended, So I don't know. I think that at some point people reach a certain amount of success. Like, did anyone try and call you an agent, Vinny? Did anyone sit there and say that you're working for the other side secretly or you have some hidden agenda or something? Has that ever happened?
I've been called an agent, a stooge, and a pedophile, and a moron, and a charlatan, and a
racist,
a murderer, a racist. I've been accused of driving people insane and making them afraid, and of course they can never produce evidence for any of these claims.
Right,
which is why the block function. Again, I reiterate.
I feel like naming all these names that you've been calling. We're laughing in the background.
Oh yeah.
It's because it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. And if somebody's being ridiculous and they don't accept a simple explanation and they assume you got something to hide when they don't have any evidence that you're actually hiding anything whatsoever, no probable cause or anything of that nature, then block them because they're clearly not in the right mind. And you don't want to have people who are crazy taunting you and attacking you and stressing you out all the time, because there are a lot of people that can still be saved from their ignorance.
And you know this whole thing with the social networking, we've been talking about this on our show quite frequently, is that you notice how there's this lack of empathy that people kind of, they can address you like you're not an actual human being. They talk to you in such a way that is so offensive and so mean and mean-spirited and ridiculing. Oh, yeah. But I mean, they would never talk to you like that if you were standing in front of them.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, you'd be surprised, actually.
Oh, well. corrected.
Some people have the gall to do it because they really are that heartless. But I remember when my friend James Wright, is a Freemason whistleblower, had an attempt on his life, and they shot out his tire and his he had this big hole through it, and it looked like they had some kind of explosive device underneath his car that malfunctioned or something like that. And all these burn marks up the back of his car over the side of the road on his way down to San Diego. A big Freemason van or something like that pulls up beside him, and then all of a sudden his car goes boom, and his tire goes flying off, and his car just kind of like comes to a screeching halt. He's just terrified, absolutely freaking terrified. And I make this quick video for him and put him up online, and on this one group people go, ha ha ha, shame, bro, if your friend just nearly died because somebody tried to just freaking murder him.
Right.
And you were running around trying to get some help or some coverage for it or something like that, and somebody laughed at you, how would you feel?
Yeah.
Right.
And the thing is, he just still continued laughing. And I left that group promptly.
Because
I think when you see terrible human behavior, it has an effect on you. You just got to freaking get by somehow. Not everybody's problems are your problems, and you can't solve them and things like that. So spend time where it's actually valued. I remember sometimes I used to back in the day, I used to let people really get to me. So like one host or one guest on my show or something wouldn't show up, and they'd be real snarky about it and kind of like mean to me and at like late notice or whatever. And I got real angry with them, really, really angry. Like just everything, but throwing stuff around, And instead of attacking them on Facebook, harassing them, starting up videos criticizing them and things of that nature, I helped 10 people instead.
Mm-hmm. I know, because it takes energy to make videos. All the stuff that they do too. It's
right.
Like you could be putting your energy into helping 10 or more people.
Yeah.
Or doing something else. Writing a song. I don't know. Learning a language. Something.
Yeah. Well, hate takes as much energy as love. And it's just, it's about 1/10 as rewarding. And I think people are talking about the karma bank. You ever heard of that phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
and I've been saying for a bit of time now, I don't believe in the Karma Bank, and I believe in the Community Bank. Whereas, let's say, for example, myself, I do a whole lot of work in the community, video Dr. Paul Connett and put his videos up on YouTube for free and all of that kind of stuff and whatnot. All the eclectic stuff that I do is not done charging anybody money. You know, occasionally they'll give me something for it, but I just ask for donations. And because I'm putting stuff up in public, into the community, and actually benefiting the community in which it stands, the public acts as my piggy bank to a degree and actually supports me in the work that I'm doing. That's not karma giving me those donations every single day. It's not karma that made me go out and help people and things of that nature. It's simply community. An actual feeling, something real tangible. Because I can't go up to Karma and go, hey, Karma bro, how come you haven't killed any Rothschilds or Rockefellers? or Karma bro, how come all the good people are living in poverty and all the real douchebags are living the lap of luxury, you know? Right. Karma bro, why is it that only good people get assassinated and bad people live forever?
It's true. They're all so old, you know, these Rockefellers.
I know. It's like into their hundreds.
And the royal family in England, they're so old. They're always into their hundreds. It's like, how do they do it? I don't know. It's
all the blood they drink, of course. It has to be.
All the fresh young virgins that we eat.
all the fresh young virgin blood, of course.
Yeah, the baby.
That's what like. Yeah.
And I'm sure the groomer of the stool has something to say about their diet.
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it's true. They always are. And but what you're offering is a community service. So that is something to be paid for. Because that's the point that I brought up. I think I did a video a while back where I talked about, you know, paying taxes. And I said, well, what if we just, you know, as a community, just pay people directly? You know, like let's you want to give your tax money away because you want to clean up a pothole. Well, what if you actually just paid the contractor who knows how to cement and who knows how to fix these things, and then you can actually, you know, get those things done, and you would know where your money went versus into this pool, which, like, God knows where it goes. You know, because they don't give you an itemized receipt. You don't know where any of this money goes.
Well,
you know?
Well, I thought two good ideas while you were saying that. Tax volunteering. Okay, let's say, for example, a tax department says you owe, I don't know, 5 Gs or whatever. Now, regardless of it being illegal, let's say, for example, it wasn't illegal and there was actually good things that was happening with that money, even though government wastes about $30 for every $1 they give you back to you. But let's say you were to volunteer a couple of hours or something like that per week or in the day or something like that, and you'd like clean up a community garden or something of that nature. You'd actually contribute something to the community in lieu of paying taxation. You can give your time rather than your money. Or if, let's say, you've got plenty of money but you've got bugger all time, you can give them some money and so that you can have some time to yourself. There's that option. Also, there's the tax checklist. All right, let's say, you know, when you vote, they send you out a voting paper or whatever. Let's say they send you out a taxing paper, and you have a checklist of all the things that you want your taxes to pay for. You, personally, I want all my money to go to these tax-funded operations. So we'll have foreign debt, foreign wars, surveilling the people, funding dangerous medical practices, and so on. And cleaning up parks and making roads and things like that. Wouldn't it be very interesting for the people to determine what the budget is for particular government operations?
Right. Yeah, isn't that a novel idea? Like full disclosure, you know, to know the budget and like know what these things, what everything was being used for and what you were paying for it. That would be really neat.
And also, if you were a tax volunteer on the other side of the spectrum and what have you, it'd be a hell of a lot nicer to have a choice about how you're forced into paying your taxation rather than having no choice about whether or not you pay your taxation or how you pay it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's the other thing too. Right.
Maybe that could be a stepping stone. A stepping stone. Right. You know, if you implement that first, and then implement the volunteer taxation system with what you want your full disclosure taxation and what you want that in. You know, it'd be kind of like transitioning from one to the other, from taxation that you don't know where it goes. That gets charged a certain amount that's determined by somebody else that you have absolutely no influence of, who has absolutely no authority or law behind what they're doing, to voluntary taxation and or volunteering and or community build-up, you know, on the other end of the spectrum. I think that society does need some form of centralization, just in terms of community responsibility. You know, people got to have water and electricity and the basics and so on and so forth. And not everybody's got the time to do it. So somebody needs to be organized and have volunteers or even paid professionals in order to do it. You know, because I think the NYPD, when it was first started, I think it was in the late 1800s or something like that. I forget how old the NYPD is, but first professional police force in the world kind of thing, or in America. Mm-hmm. And they had such a low budget that they had to make all their badges out of roofing copper. And that's why people called them coppers, which was later shortened to cops.
Oh. I had no idea.
Yeah. And they used to be loved by the community because there was a lot of violence and theft going on, and they'd just start walking around and just keeping the peace, and people would bake them pies, they would talk to them, they would inform them about crimes that had been going on in the area and things like that, and certain criminals that they thought that they should have a look for, because policing is about being in touch with the community, not just the criminal element. Okay, because if you're only going after criminals, then you see everybody as a criminal, including the innocent ones.
Right.
Whereas I think the main point about policing that people need to take, and particularly take this out of the old English policing style, which was you can accomplish a hell of a lot more with a pen and paper than you can with a gun or a taser. You know, let's say, for example, you wanted to find a criminal. Where the hell would he hide if the entire community talks to and is friendly with the police? You know? And the police would only be talkative and friendly if they weren't trying to beat up everybody all the time and kill people and get away with it, you know? We had this big incident in New Zealand. I'm sorry, I'm talking quite a bit, aren't I?
Well, on your show? No, yeah, you can't talk a lot on your show.
No. Well, actually, you really shouldn't talk a lot on your own show, apparently, unless you're just kind of doing it solo or whatever. But anyway, we had this incident in New Zealand where these two boys, you know, like 20-year-olds or whatever, were raping girls and putting up videos on YouTube talking about, yeah, we raped these girls and stuff like that, and the police didn't do nothing. All right, and then a left-wing journalist in New Zealand, Bomber Bradbury, criticised the police for not taking action, and then the police, instead of taking action and arresting rapists, they fine Bomber Bradbury, they're going to take him to court, and he's either going to get a huge fine or go to jail.
Wow.
For criticising the police for not arresting and rapists who admit that they're rapists. Does that sound like a trustworthy police force to you? And the police are saying that what Bomber did is that he distilled mistrust and a lack of faith in the police, and that they don't want to deal with that negative publicity. And I go, well, here's a way for you to stop negative publicity. Stop protecting rapists and stop killing people.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that, you know, fair enough, you know? Hey, everybody, I arrest rapists and don't kill innocent people. Hey, well, that's respectable as opposed to the opposite.
Yeah, I know.
Right, they did that to themselves by not protecting the people, you know, and defending rapists. And then they blame the person who called them out for it. It's like these guys who go after these whistleblowers, you know, and they say that they're unpatriotic or that they're putting us all in risk. It's like, well, you're the one who's doing these illegal wars in the first place, so what do you mean? You know, this guy's just telling us that.
I know. Right? No, they just made you look stupid and embarrassed you. That's why you're angry. they're not putting us in danger or putting, yeah, you know.
No, well, they're the ones that are putting us in danger. They're the ones who are like out there and, you know.
No, but not the whistleblowers, right?
Right,
not the they're mad at the whistleblowers, but they're mad at the whistleblowers because the whistleblowers made them look stupid or expose them.
Yeah,
put them on blast in slang terms, right?
Yeah.
That's why they're mad.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It was like whistleblowers or what have you. Oh, Vinny, this person is having terrible stuff happen to him. I don't know why. Do they work to a massive organization that involves lots of money? Yeah. Are they about to expose that massive organization that has a lot of money? Yeah. Are they going to threaten their business practice or credibility and maybe even threaten a few incredibly powerful people's jobs or employment or reputation or anything of that nature? Yeah. Are they doing the right thing by doing this? Yeah. Okay. Then that makes sense.
Right. Exactly. But it's just, it shows to show, you know, how we talk about this sometimes a lot, but it, and in our movement, I think, and it almost becomes like cliche.
It's the whole
Orwellian thing. You know, it's the Orwellian. It's like everything is backwards, but it really is. It's really, you know, the people who are claiming that these whistleblowers are putting us in harm are actually the ones that are putting you in harm. You know, because they're the ones that are sending young people out to Afghanistan and to burn villages and rape and kill children, you know?
Kill it's like, and then they come back and they kill themselves, so...
Right,
know.
Exactly. And then they're saying, well, but then these guys who expose that are the ones that are actually doing it. No, by exposing it, they're actually maybe giving people a fighting chance to avoid going, you know, they because maybe they have a false sense of that they're going to actually help, maybe because they don't know the official story of 9/11. They don't know this whole thing is BS. And so they think they're helping their country by going into the military. And if by learning that maybe that's not a good idea because these people are all liars and they're actually hurting and killing children and murdering babies and doing all these horrible, horrible, horrible things that they're sent there to do because of why? Because they're chasing energy, they're chasing oil, they're, you know, looking for natural gas or whatever it is that they're doing. You know, it's certainly not to protect anybody.
Yeah. You get this assumptive criticism or cynicism, with truthers these days, you know. It's like, it was quite funny, actually. My missus told me, Vinny, did you hear that there was a massive truck bomb that they found in Times Square? And I go, ah, don't worry about it, baby. It's probably the FBI. And it was.
Yeah, right.
And I came to a profound realization that day. When bombs get found, it's usually because they're the FBI. When bombs go off, it's because it's the CIA.
Mm. Oh. Wow.
Yeah, that's it. That's interesting thing to say, you know. But I guess there's a sort of cynicism maybe in the truth movement, or sometimes do you get accused of being like too quick to call something a false flag? Like when Sandy Hook happened, I went, oh, like that looks really false flag.
Oh yeah, we're over it. We're just like, psh.
But you know, but yeah. I mean, but people will say, oh, you know, you're so quick to call something a false flag, you conspiracy theorist, you know.
Well, not everything is a false flag, April. Not everything.
Right. That's not everything is a false flag.
People tell me that all the time. Vinny, not everything's a conspiracy. And I go, I know not everything's a conspiracy, just most things.
Right. No, I mean, but well, to call something a conspiracy or to be called a conspiracy theorist is considered to be kind of a slur, or it's kind of a, or even to be called a truther. But I find that kind of funny, because what's the opposite of a truther? Wouldn't that be a liar? So if it's an insult to be called a truther, is that a compliment to be called a liar? You know, I mean, is it really that if you know anything about history and you know that there are so many conspiracies that happen all the time. I mean, even you go to your kid's local playground at the schoolyard and you'll see kids like plotting conspiracies, you know. It's just normal. People do it all the time. But yet they say it's a slur to be called a conspiracy theorist, or it makes you somehow irrational. But I would say you're irrational to think that they don't exist.
Yeah.
When that, you know, so I don't mind. People can call me, they can call it a slur. To me, it doesn't feel like a slur.
Yeah. Miss Hoover, Jimmy said he's going to put toxic mercury in the vaccines. Oh, Thomas, you're just a conspiracy theorist. Go back and play in the sand.
But little kids will conspire against each other, though, no? I mean, you know, they'll say, let's when Hannah comes in the classroom, let's pretend like we don't see her. You know, I mean, they'll do something like that to each other, right?
Well, they'll say, don't talk to each other. Don't talk to her. We're not her friend anymore. You know, I've seen kids do that. She's like the isolation shit.
Exactly. You know? But then to be called a conspiracy theorist, that's to be crazy. But when conspiracies happen all of the time. So what's wrong about theorizing about it if you know from history that they occur? I don't see that as a problem.
Hold on,
I don't mind any of the slurs. They call them slurs. I don't care. Conspiracy theorists, you know, Tim, like, whatever, fine, you know. It doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. The slurs that really bother me are drunken slurs, you know? mostly because I don't understand what they're saying, and I fear what I don't understand.
That's a good point. Drunken slurs. Yeah. That's funny. We have I'm of Irish descent. I'm red hair and freckly, and someone recently said that I already heard it said that, you know, people who are red hair and freckly are weaker, they have a weaker constitution, or their immune systems are more sensitive. And I was
on gingers?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, they actually, there might be some truth to that, but the fact that I was like, well, you know, if you really think that that red hair and you really think that gingers are weaker, I suggest you go to Ireland and start a bar fight and just see what happens. Test that theory out at a bar in Ireland.
Like Lewis Black, he said, in Ireland, there's no such thing as Alcoholics Anonymous, because whenever there's a meeting, it's always at the bar. and there's no violence. You know, it's like, God damn you, son of a bitch, and then they pass out.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, but that was just a joke. So I don't know if that's true or not. I actually think that it is, because in our community, in the autism community, I used to go to these conferences, and I would see, you know, red hair is pretty rare, but there's quite a few gingers in the community. So what it is about us, or that it is, you know, genetically that makes us or have kind of a weaker immune system, I don't know, but I have sort of seen that out in play. But it was just a funny thing to say, because, you know, Irish aren't necessarily weak people, but, you know, maybe they're more susceptible or have something genetically that doesn't allow us to detox as easily or something like that.
Well, I think I also interviewed Pam Killeen about this, and she says that every bloodline has its kind of foods that it's really good at processing. Like, she came from ginger roots as well, you know. My ginger roots. and apparently incredibly good at processing pork products, and can draw a lot of nutrition out of them that other people's digestive systems can't.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, and everybody's got different propensities to different things. Like, some people are really, really bad with meat of any kind because their genetic roots stretch back to places where there weren't really a whole lot of animals to eat and stuff like this. It's very similar to Darwin's finches, in a way, whereby the environment determines a lot of the characteristics that you have, but it doesn't radically change the organism.
Mm.
You know,
gotcha.
Like, it's, you can tell they're both finches, but their beaks are slightly different because they eat slightly different food. Just like you can tell that a ginger person and a dark person are still both human beings, but they have different pigments, and they have different susceptibility to diets and diseases and so on and so forth. Everybody's freaking different. We're all snowflakes.
Right. Exactly.
And some of us are just flakes.
Yeah. And us gingers were, you know, as white as a snowflake behind the freckles. We're spotted snowflakes.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, Miss Spotted Snowflake and Miss African Queen Latifah lookalike winner, we will. That could be construed as an insult, but it was meant as a compliment.
I know.
I would like you to just wrap this up by giving us again a quick, brief rundown of your radio show, your websites, Facebook stuff, or whatever you feel like chucking in there, and we'll wrap it all up. You said you'd only give me 2 hours. It's already been three or more. So.
I know, we lied. We lied because we're having so much fun. I had to do some stuff.
Well, on air, but let's just say I manipulated you. Okay. Because when you said 2 hours, I go, nah, these girls are going to have so much fun. They're going to stay for 3 hours and they're going to be late. And I didn't say that because I knew that if I told you up front that it would actually wind up being 3 hours, you wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, you know, yeah, just on the spot at the time, I guess it was scary, but yeah, I mean, I had a great time. So you can find
a web. You're very charming.
You're charming and funny, and yes. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Apparently it's the accent. I thought for a long time that people laughed at my jokes because they were witty and clever and whatnot, but it turns out it's just a speech impediment.
We're just making fun of you, babe. We're laughing at you, not with you, basically.
He's got a funny accent.
anyway, you can find our website at truthortalk.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We just joined a radio station, UCY.TV. Yeah, is there anything else you would like to add to that, April?
No, just like she said, everything is on truthortalk.com, our essays, our archived shows, and our new network is UCY.TV, so check us out.
Oh,
thanks.
Oh, we air Sundays Pacific Standard Time from 2 to 5 p.m. So.
In the United States.
In the United States. Vinny in New Zealand, yes, right.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Nice. So. And I presume there's online streams available as well.
Yes.
Yeah, archive. You can go to, when you go to the website, you can go to show episodes, and that has, we've done about 60 so far, 61. Mm-hmm. So they're all archived. Yeah, they're all archived. You can listen to your heart's content. So.
All right. Truthortalk.com, ladies and gentlemen, for April Bowden and Verstein Henry, two very lovely girls. Thank you very much for spending the time with me.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. And bear in mind, listeners, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so it only keeps going because of you. That's right. This is all your fault. So keep donating at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. We've moved into a larger house now, so we're able to bring in guests into studio, and we've got a second computer to train people how to do the iMovie and GarageBand and basically produce your own radio shows and videos and documentaries. So, you know, if you're in Auckland and you're an activist of some description and you want to learn from me how to do all this kind of stuff, you can come in and you'll work on my radio shows and my videos and things like that. I'll instruct you how to do them. And then once you've figured out how to do them, you can do them on your own without my help. And I would rather you go out there, be skilled in order to produce yourself and not need me to do it for you anymore. The way that this is meant to work in terms of Guerrilla Media House is to just empower people with the skills and if hopefully one day if when enough donations come in, actually buy people like a computer or something like that, so that when you're doing your activism, you're going out there, you're exposing the court system or the child kidnapping rings in New Zealand or in any of these other branches of eclectic scumbaggery. Wouldn't it be great if you didn't need anybody to help you to expose that scumbaggery? Mm-hmm. That's the idea. Give you some independence. Give you the stuff that you need. All right. Hopefully that'll produce a better society and a more cohesive alternative media, because nobody will need any central branch of alternative media to give them credibility or airtime, because they can provide it for themselves. That's the idea. All right. Thank you, girls. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll see you again sometime.
Exception, you are the only exception.